Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to the October 17, 2016 meeting of the Chelan Public Utility District. Today's meeting this morning will be a study session and this afternoon a business session. For this morning's conduct of business, all five commissioners will be here. Commissioner Congdon will be a few minutes late. Our general manager will be here. He'll be a few minutes late. We have the other regular staff, with the exception of sitting in for Eric Walquist, is Karen Wiggum as counsel. And at this time, I'd like to let people know that we welcome you and like having you here at our meetings. If you do wish to speak to any item on the agenda today, we ask that you come forward to the table and, for the record, give us your name and address in the microphone, and since our meetings are recorded, we do need to have that and would appreciate you to do that. And also would request that this time cell phones be silenced or turned off, one or the other. That's very helpful to the conduct of the meeting. And I believe that's all the opening ideas I have, or thoughts I have. And our first item on the agenda, as we always do, we will start with the Pledge of Allegiance and our safety minute, led by Felicity Saberhagen. It's beyond, we've moved it behind you.
Oh. I pledge
allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning. Most of you are probably aware that the month of October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, but what most of you probably don't know is that the third week of October is National School Bus Safety Week. Students are about 50 times more likely to arrive alive at school if they take the school bus than if they drive themselves or ride with friends. Not only that, but children are much safer riding the bus than being driven by their parents. More children are hit by cars at or near schools than any other location, and fatality rates are highest the hour before and after school. School buses keep an estimated 17.3 million cars off the road, surrounding each school each morning, and are the safest way for children to get to school. Their design is meant to be safer than any passenger vehicle in avoiding crashes and preventing injuries. Illegal passing of school buses is a problem across the nation. As a driver, be aware that it is illegal to pass any bus operating either flashing red lights or displaying a stop sign. This includes traffic in either direction on the road. Drivers must remain stopped until the bus remains in motion or the signal is no longer activated. Please slow down in designated school zones. The speed limit is 20 miles per hour, and breaking the speed limit will earn you a ticket double the cost of a normal amount. If you do drive your children to school, you can increase the safety of your child and others. Don't double park. It decreases the visibility for children and vehicles. Don't load and unload children across the street from school. Drop them off in front of the school and follow the drop-off procedures. Most schools have them. And remember, the safest route from to and from schools is on the school bus.
Thank you, Felicity.
Thank you.
You know, that's especially timely as our days get shorter, and now school buses are loading and unloading a lot of times in the dark, and that even makes it, you know, I think all of us have those areas where we know we've just got to pay attention because kids aren't, and
that's right.
We got to take care of them.
And in Wenatchee, it's pretty easy to pass two or three school zones driving to and work to work each day.
Yes.
Please be careful. Thank you.
Thank you. Item two on the agenda is the approval of the agenda. At this time, I'd like to make one adjustment on this afternoon's agenda with the permission of the commission, and that is moving item 15 up ahead of our regular agenda to right below item 9. That's to facilitate. We anticipate some people being here early in the afternoon and would like to cover the Alcoa update and status at that time to help those people if they do need to leave. So we'll, that's the only recommended change that I have. Any others from any of my fellow commissioners?
No.
All right. Hearing none, we will move to item three, water system update plan details with Ron Slabaugh.
Good morning, Commissioners. We're here for a detailed update on the Wenatchee Water System Plan and the Water Use Efficiency Plan for all of our water systems. Thank you. Of course, no action requested today. This is the wrong presentation. Excuse me.
Yes, right. Yeah. That was October 3rd.
There we go.
Thank you. Yeah, actually, Ron, you probably could have used it as a test to see if the commission was paying attention.
Well, the first thing that set me off was the date. Okay, so we're good. No action requested, as I indicated, just an overview of the Wenatchee Water System Plan and the Water Use Efficiency Program for each of our systems, and of course, next steps in this process. Major components of a water system plan. Department of Health is a regulatory agency overseeing our public water systems. We need to update our water system plan every 6 years, and this is for the Department of Health's water system planning guidance. These are the items that they like to see there. General description of the water system. Basic planning data is our service area. We look at population and land use, and from that we're able to project demands for the six-year period of the plan. We analyze the system. We look at capacity, capability, compare it to the Department of Health's Water System Design Manual. I mentioned the Water Use Efficiency Program. We'll cover that later in this presentation. Source water protection and water rights for the Wenatchee system. Of course, we purchase all of our water from regional, so everything to do with source water is covered in regional's water system plan. Operation and maintenance. Department of Health wants us to demonstrate that we are adequately taking care of the system and that we have the appropriate number of qualified staff available. Our distribution system design and construction standards. This is key. It's not a required component of the plan, but we always submit it because in doing so, we are able to make improvements to our distribution system, primarily these water main replacement projects, without submitting the plans to Department of Health for approval. So they approve our design and construction standards one time, and then for the next 6 years, we can move on with those replacements without their oversight. The capital improvement program, of course, the financial program showing revenues and expenses and that we can actually afford what we propose, and appendices. Our Wenatchee water system, you've heard me mention before, it's one of the more complex systems in the state. 26 pressure zones, 25 those reservoirs that set up on the hills, 17 pump stations, 17 pressure reducing stations, about 160 miles of main, just under 6,000 service connections. And we deliver about 720 million gallons to our customers annually that we purchase from regional.
So, Ron, I'm just a quick question. Is Commissioner Arsenault in pressure zone number 26?
25 or 26. I'm not exactly certain of your address. But, yeah, he's certainly up there. I completed our analysis. This is the six-year improvement program that is proposed in this comp plan. Over the last decade and a half, PUD has made considerable investments in the system and to provide capacity within our service area. We don't need to make any capacity improvements this time around. For pump stations, we have some minor repairs totaling about $15,000, but we don't need to upgrade the capacity of any stations or build any additional stations. Storage reservoirs, capacity-wise, we're in pretty good shape, but we had three in the analysis that we inherited when we got into the water system, in the water business in January of 74 that structurally are deficient and they're approaching the end of their useful life. Two of those we need to replace, totaling about $1.9 million. And one would be we no longer need it. We have constructed over the years additional reservoirs, and we have adequate distribution system capacity that we'll simply abandon and demolish that tank. And we have minor repairs of $75,000, and that's specifically our OMI reservoir. We need to go in and rehab the roof of that tank in order to realize additional life from that asset. Distribution system, throughout the years, we've always replaced sections of our distribution system, primarily steel and galvanized mains that we, again, inherited when we got into the water business, and they've approached the end of their useful life. We will continue with that. One thing I want to mention here is we do have a line item in our long-term forecast for replacing our AMR system. We installed the original system beginning in 06, completed in 07, and at that time we projected that it would last somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 years. So that puts that replacement out at year 2022. We can't say with certainty that that is exactly when we'll replace it, but nonetheless it is in our long-term forecast. But replacement of that is not contemplated in this particular plan. The total current capital program recommended in this plan is just under $8 million. It's worth noting that the 2015 budget forecast for the same time period was about $2.2 million. Why the big difference? Well, we didn't have this plan. That particular budget forecast was at the end of the last comprehensive planning cycle. We had completed the improvements in that plan. And all we had identified in our capital forecast at that time were some minimal water main replacements. So, of course, with this new plan, where we have updated our budget forecast. Okay, the financial analysis, make some assumptions here going into the next 6 years.
Can we go back around? That includes the water main upgrades?
Yes. Okay. The $7.7 million, yes. We forecast that revenues will increase about 2% due to system growth, and of course 2% for the rate increases that the board adopted last year through 2019. Beyond 2019, we assume a 2% CPI increase would be implemented. Capital improvements funded by rates and existing system cash. We don't anticipate that we would require any other funding sources. Good news, even with the large increase in the forecast, all the financial policies that the board adopted last year will still be met through 2022. Liquidity specifically will stay over $2 million. The target was $1.25 million. Debt ratio of less than 15%, and the target was actually less than 60%, indicated we don't anticipate taking on any more debt. O&M coverage target of something greater than 120%, and we'll be over 135%. For the period of this plan. Let's move over to water use efficiency. So this is one component of the Municipal Water Act of 2003. So this will be the second water use efficiency program that we're going to ask the board to adopt at a later presentation. The first one we adopted for our large Wenatchee system on July of 2007. And for the smaller systems in November of 2008. Key elements, we have to meet a distribution system leakage standard. So we measure the water that we pump into the distribution system, and we measure the water, of course, that we sell to our customers. And the difference is the distribution system leakage. It's a little bit more complex than that. Distribution system leakage does include meter inaccuracy. We have a motivation to keep accurate meters in our system to keep the distribution system leakage down. We are also allowed to estimate non-metered use, like water used for fighting fires, for example, water used for flushing for water quality, or for new construction and things of that nature. within establishing a water use efficiency program, we take a look at our water system data and look for opportunities to use water more efficiently. We have to set quantifiable and measurable goals using a public process. We evaluate and we implement measures to achieve those goals. And those are essentially programs that help our customers use water more efficiently. And we have to report annually to the Department of Health our progress on achieving those goals. Distribution system leakage for our four systems. Department of Health asks that we report this in a three-year average, and that helps attenuate any highs or lows that we might have or data anomalies. The target is to be less than 10%. The Wenatchee system's current three-year average is just under 9%, and 4 years ago we began leak detecting the system, where we hire a contractor that comes in. They use the listening equipment. They install these devices on the system, and they have set of headphones, and they listen. And water escaping a hole through a pipe and high pressure makes a specific sound. And that's been successful for us. We found leaks in each of the 4 years, and we've gone out and replaced those. That's got us from in the late 2000, 2007, 2008 time frame, we were in the mid-teens for distribution system leakage. Now we're down, actually the last 2 years, we've been about 6%. Cool. But our three-year average is at that 8.7. We're on track to leak detect the system. We do about 10% a year, so we want to complete it every 10 years. And it's something that we anticipate we'll continue to do. We'll go right back to the first place that we leak detected and start over again. Alala Canyon's always been really good, 3%. Chelan Ridge, same thing, it's a very tight system. Dryden, we've always calculated pretty high leakage over the last several years. 36.7% sounds high for a three-year average, and it is. From a quantity basis, it's about 5 gallons per minute. We've done everything that we can think of to look for that leak. We just haven't been able to find it yet. We did leak detect the entire system. One limitation with leak detection on a system like Dryden, the distribution mains are PVC, so it attenuates that signal some. We just can't hear leaks as well as we can with our ductile iron pipe. We actually took the reservoir out of service a few years ago. We isolated it from the system and ran a regular American Water Works Association leak test, and the reservoir does not leak at all. We checked the check valves in the wells. Not perhaps something could have been leaking back there, and it wasn't. We isolated the wells from service, and we still realized this leakage. So we've done everything reasonable that we think we can to try to find this leakage. We haven't yet. We'll continue to try to come up with other ways to find it. But again, at 5 gallons per minute, it isn't worth putting a whole lot more resources into.
Out of curiosity, that have you been able to determine, is that a constant leak, or is it worse sometimes than others?
It's constant. One thing with a system like Dryden that we can do, because it's primarily residential, is look at the rate that the reservoir is drawn down from, say, 1 to 4 a.m., and it should be fairly flat. With Dryden, it's not. It's a fairly constant drawdown. So we're reasonably confident we do indeed have a leak somewhere. Just like I mentioned, we're unable to find it. The ground is taking the water wherever it is.
Interesting.
I mentioned one component of the water use efficiency rules, to take a look at our data. Since our systems are primarily residential, we tend to focus on looking at the residential data and where we can use water more efficiently. Have each of our four systems here. You can see the blue lines are Wenatchee system, and over the last 6 years, our residential average household use has been right at that 200 gallons per day per home. And it's been very similar for Alala and Dryden as well. You'll see a little bit more variability with Alala and Dryden, which is common for a smaller system. But they're right in that 200 gallon per day range. It's interesting to note that 200 gallon per day is what the Department of Health has found to be the typical for household use in Washington State. So no outdoor use, just household use. Now, of course, our customers do use water for some outdoor use. We have irrigation in some areas of the system, but not others. So being down around that 200 gallons per day for mixed household plus outdoor use is really, really good. For systems like this in a low rainfall area like Wenatchee, we receive a little bit less than 10 inches of rain per year. Department of Health has also identified that general average use is in the 500 to 600 gallon per day range. As I indicated, we're doing really well already. Our neighbors in the city of Wenatchee and East Wenatchee water districts use is a little over 300 gallons per day.
Really?
Yeah. They have single tier rates, or last I checked, they did, and their rates are a bit less than what ours are.
They have less alternate sources of irrigation available over there also?
I'm not sure.
Yep. Could be a driver.
Yeah, certainly.
For lawns.
Okay, for setting water use efficiency goal, there's no minimum number of goals. Just need to be designed to encourage efficient use and must be quantifiable and measurable. So for each of these systems, I indicated, performance-wise, we're doing really, really well. We don't see a lot more opportunity for significant reductions in our residential water use. Now, keep in mind, when the municipal water law was enacted, including the water use efficiency program, there's a lot of systems out there that didn't have source meters and certainly didn't have customer meters, and there's several that still do not. So there were systems that used a lot of water, and those were really the ones that the Department of Health was targeting for reductions. At that time, we already had good source meters, good customer meters, and a water use efficiency program. And I'll touch on the measures that we've had in the past and we're going to continue to continue into the future. So with that in mind, we just want to try to maintain the great work that we've done in the past. So for the Wenatchee system, try to keep the average day demand for residential under 210 gallons per day, Dryden less than 250, Olalla less than 250, and Chelan Ridge less than 275. I believe the primary driver for Chelan Ridge being a little higher than the other systems is there is no irrigation water in Chelan Ridge. Our source is the only that's available out there. Our various measures, of course, I mentioned the conservation rates. The less a customer uses, the more that they save. We have our lightly email newsletter that we send out with information to customers on how they can use water efficiently. Through AMR, the AMR transmitters that we have, when we go out and read the system every month, if it senses that a customer has a leak on their side of the meter, it alerts us to that, and we can communicate that information to the customer. Water meter monitoring, we have a small device that customers can check out, and it's programmed to their water transmitter. They can hang it on their fridge, and they can go, say, take a shower and click it and see how many gallons they used or see how much they're using with their irrigation system. Meter data recording is another device, and actually the newer transmitters now have meter data recording incorporated right into them, and that's where we can actually go download, say, 30 days worth of customer water data and share that information with them so they can have an idea how much that they have used each day over a series of days. On our website, we have our xeriscaping program, you know, low water use landscaping. We do have a very comprehensive website, different programs that are available, and links to other websites that encourage efficient water use. And we have staff with the capability to go out and help customers with outdoor water audits. And primarily, that's just looking at their irrigation system and where there's opportunity for improvements to use less water. Next steps, this next week, we will be advertising for the meeting on November 7th, where we will formally present the water system plan and request that the board adopt water use efficiency goals. And that will be the final time for the public to come in and comment. November 22nd, we'll submit all of our documentation to the Department of Health. We have to wait for those 2 weeks. As part of that documentation needs to include the approved minutes from this board from the November 7th meeting. Of course, on December 5th, when the board will be asked to approve the budget, which includes the capital improvement program in this particular water system plan. And we'll, at that point, we wait for the Department of Health to get back to us with that the plan is ready to approve. I'll come back to you one last time, request that you adopt the plan, and we will be done for another 6 years. Questions, comments?
Question. Going back to the leak detection, You know, when you do these leak detections, do you do it just at a period of time during the year, or do you randomly go around and check it periodically at different times of the year in order to have a, you know, full understanding? You know, because if it's a leak that's being used at, like, in the summer, maybe it's somebody irrigating, something like that, that's not detected.
Sure.
And so you do that throughout the year to make sure that 5 gallons, because that's a lot of water when you add it up over the course of a...
Oh, it is.
You know, a day or
it certainly
a year.
Is. You know, where we mentioned Dryden was at, what, 5 gallons per minute?
A minute, yeah.
Each percent in the Wenatchee system is a little over 700 gallons.
Well, I mean, my point is, if you're measuring at 5 gallons a minute, is that consistently per minute all throughout the year, or is there a large discharge or something like that?
No, a leak will be 24/7.
24/7?
And it'll usually increase over time as the water that's leaking out the pipe will erode, you know, the hole that's leaking out will get bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. But we typically conduct our leak investigations in October after irrigation has gone down.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we're out there and we hear various irrigation leaks that aren't part of our system. Because, of course, our pipes are located in the same areas where a lot of these private irrigation systems are, and we can hear their leaks.
So, but when you come up to this 5 gallons a minute, that's assessing the total leakage for the year?
That's correct.
So you don't know if it's a large leak or...
It could be several small leaks, and that could be why we're having such a difficult time finding it.
Okay.
Okay. Anything else?
And that's all PVC in that particular system?
The majority of Dryden has PVC mains, yes.
Yeah.
And the pressure is lower up there, so a combination of PVC and lower pressure makes it more challenging to hear with the leak detection equipment.
Ron, is any of the budget, is any of that going to be used up in the Dryden area to maybe track that down? Or what's the resolution to Dryden? Are we just going to leave that continue?
We're not certain what else to do. Over the last couple of years, the leak hasn't got any worse. It's right in that 40% range. And so I've even spoken with some of our peers at other PUDs about what else to look for. And we're not certain what to do, so we track it. And as far as funding goes, Dryden's a part of our system, just like, you know, Wenatchee, Dryden, Alala, and Chelan Ridge. So we have one O&M program. We certainly have resources to go up there, just not sure what else to do.
Yeah. So it's not part of the budget that we're looking at.
To go do additional evaluation.
7.7 doesn't include any.
No.
Okay. No. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
One other question as far as the system in Dryden. Did we replace the system from source to customer, the entire system, or is there some areas there between source and customer service that was not replaced by?
Before my time, but I did find a set of plans that appears that we replaced a distribution system sometime in the early 1980s.
From source to the customer base.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think Dryden used to be a spring back in the day, and there was a couple wells that were drilled down in town.
Well, I bring this up because, you know, I sit on the water district in Beshaston, and we had a similar issue. And we discovered later on through, you know, metering, different things, that it wasn't a leak. It was actually another customer that was hooked on that wasn't somehow evaded the metering process.
Yeah.
And it was significant.
You know, we had thought about that, and if the usage varied some throughout the year or throughout the day, we would investigate that more, but it doesn't.
It doesn't.
It's consistent.
Okay. That's why I asked.
Day after day after day, when we look at that reservoir drawdown, it just doesn't change.
I guess my concern is if you multiply that out for a year, you're about 2.5 million gallons.
About right.
And that's a lot of hydraulic pressure ultimately building up in the soil. So I've just, you know, I think maybe that's a concern.
For what it's worth, the ground does take it out
right
there. So our wells are in hydraulic connection with the rivers. So
supplementing the river.
Yeah, and then we put it back into the ground and it flows back into the river.
Okay. As long as it's got an outlet.
It yeah. Soils are reasonably porous in
yeah
that area.
There's a lot of river rock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Item 4, 2016-17 Public Power Benefit Projects Update.
I'll take a second to introduce this one. Earlier this year, we had a discussion about public power benefit projects, and you made some allocations for the both 2016 and 2017. And we said we want to get back together in the October timeframe with the expectation that some of the feasibility work would be accomplished and we could decide whether you wanted to make further allocations of those dollars. At this point, the two biggest projects for feasibility studies, the splash pad and the visitor center at Rocky Reach, the feasibility work is not complete. We're pretty close and hoping to be able to get back to you in November. And so we are not bringing this back with the expectation of making a decision about further allocations. But we thought it's still worthwhile to go through the update and remind you about how many dollars have been spent. Recall that there is no requirement that you spend all the money that's allocated. It's up to your discretion as to how much will be spent. And so you want to just take a look. We'll give you an update on how much money we forecast to spend, what potentially is left out of that, and then go through project by project and give you an update. So that's a lot of information. We're going to try to move through this relatively quickly, though, because we're not asking for a decision today and just providing you an update. Jeff, turn it over to you.
Thank you, Steve, and good morning, Commissioners. Jeff Smith, Managing Director of District Services.
Felicity Saberhagen, Business Advisor.
And as Steve indicated, we are here to provide you with a status report on 10 of the 13 public power benefit projects. We'll begin with a summary report on public power benefit program funding for 2016 and 2017 with Felicity, and that would direct you to your attention to page 3 of your document.
The table before you represents a summary of the allocation and use of funding from the Public Power Benefits Program. The second column represents the total 2016 amount that was available and the amounts that have been allocated during 2016 for each of the projects. And down at the bottom, we have the total allocated amount and then also the remainder that is pending to be allocated, which gives us $2.75 million that's still remaining to be allocated. Column 3 represents the total amounts, including 2017, that have been allocated to each project. As you can see, we have allocated $7.4 million total funding to all of the projects. You'll be receiving updates on each of those. To note, one of those projects, we have had to add $10,000. We did a budget revision to the electric economic analysis tool to make sure that we were able to completely fund that project. The original estimate on that was $250,000, so I think we probably pretty much got a bargain at $40,000 to complete that project. The forecast spending right now is about $7.3 million. Whatever's not spent in that could be, in theory, added back to the amounts that could be reallocated for other use.
Now, is that for total or for this year or for through, you know?
That's a great point. So this is the pace of the spending is going to determine when that gets spent. So these projects are allocated until they're completed, so they won't necessarily be completed in this calendar year.
These aren't budget amounts. These are allocation amounts, which is different.
The forecast amount would be the amount that we predict we will spend over time.
Right.
But again, the pacing may vary.
Right.
So, and spent to date, we have spent $1.7 million in public power benefits to date, which is column 3. On the next page,
she's got the clicker.
Oops. We have I'm just summarizing here the amount that has been allocated for 2017. We started with $4 million. The initial allocations, we've already allocated $2.1 million for the fiber expansion program. That's included on the page that you saw before. The $71,000 for the state park passes and $30,000 for camping at BB Park. That leaves a remainder of $1.8 million, roughly, to be allocated. When you look at the total remaining for 2016 and 2017, that's about $4.5 million that we have available still to allocate.
Okay.
Were there any questions on that?
Okay. Thank you, Felicity. So the fiber system expansion update will also be provided at a later date. We're going to start with the State Parks Day Use Parking Pass project. Michelle Smith is a reporter. And while she's coming up here, I'll just mention, jumping ahead, the Horan Natural Area Rehabilitation Project is also on the list, involves work on the drainage ditch and stormwater runoff diversion and treatment to provide a permanent supply of water to the habitat area ponds. This is a collaborative effort with the City of Wenatchee. The city is committed to funding feasibility of the stormwater getting to the Horan area. The district will determine how best to receive the stormwater. The city will continue to pursue grant funding from Ecology once design is complete, and that project is on schedule. And jumping back now to day use parking pass.
Thank you, Jeff. Michelle Smith, manager of Hydro Licensing. I wanted to just give you an update on the wrap-up for the parking pass that was an 18-month pilot program. We stopped distributing passes at the end of September, so we have some wrap-up numbers for you. We have just over 2,400 passes that were distributed during the 18 months, and that amount that we paid to state parks for those was about $72,000. That was considering about $30 per pass, as we agreed with state parks during the pilot program. And we're starting to launch and get ready for the 2017 program, which we expect that budget to be a little bit lower because we're working with state parks to try and lower the amount that we're going to pay per pass. In fact, we have a meeting tomorrow to try and finalize the discussions and see where we're going to go with that. So we'll be planning to bring back to you the final outcome of that discussion once we have that meeting tomorrow. So one of the things I wanted to let you know in terms of the program and the pilot program was that the process worked very well. So we had a lot of staff time spent in the very beginning trying to get the implementation of the program going. But once we got there, things went really smoothly. So I anticipate next year will go well, and we're working right now with the Communications Department to try and make sure that we're marketing and getting the word out about the program so we can get as many people as we can involved with that.
Michelle, State Parks has their own pass system for statewide. Mm-hmm. What's the price on that?
$30 per pass for statewide.
And we're paying $30 just for our own.
That's right. And we agreed to do that because we didn't know what kind of impact that this would be to the state's program, and we wanted to make sure that we weren't negatively impacting their revenues by taking away potentially people that might be paying for a Discover Pass that might now start paying for our pass. The outcome of that during the pilot was that we have a relatively small impact to their overall program. So we're coming back together and talking about, okay, what does the future look like now from a financial perspective?
Other questions? Go ahead.
I'm trying to understand how do you impact the state if you're charging a fee and then you're reallocating that fee back to the state? I mean, how would that affect? Seems like you're just taking it out of one pocket and giving it to them.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. One of the things that State Parks was, they split the $30 is actually WDFW, DNR, and State Parks. So when we all buy, whoever buys a Discover Pass, they split a percentage of that off to those other state agencies. And so what we wanted to make sure is that if we were starting a program where now someone that might have bought a Discover Pass to use one of those state parks are now using a PUD pass, that could mean that now the state's not getting that fund unless we.
But aren't we giving those monies to the state?
We are now, yes. So we're basically agreed during the pilot to pay the $30. And then, Commissioner, what we're proposing then is we're working with State Parks to change that now that the pilot is finishing. So next year we're hoping that will be a lower amount. And it's looking like it will be. I just not ready, prepared yet to bring forward a number because we haven't finished discussing that with them.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Other questions?
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you. Next one is the BB Bridge camping pilot. That's expected to begin April 1st. Each Chelan PUD customer household will be eligible for up to two nights of free camping at one of three to four sites that will be earmarked at BB Bridge for this purpose. This program will be actively marketed to all demographics, including the diverse leadership group, to help engage low-income and Hispanic Latino customer owners. We're planning to use a reservation system for the pilot. Budgeted cost is $30,000. Our next update is the electric vehicle charging stations project. Andrew Gassell is the lead on that. And while he's coming up here, I'll mention Jumping ahead, the electric economic analysis tool is complete. This will be used to assess the benefits and impacts of new businesses locating in Chelan County. And we'll be back to provide additional details about this project during your November 21st board meeting. Andrew.
May I interrupt before you move on, Jeff? On the BB Bridge Park camping pilot, so why did we choose, why did you choose BB Bridge Park? I forget why. Because it was not as used as much as some of the others?
Michelle, you want to come up here and participate in this again? BB Bridge is the one that's owned by the district that has overnight camping. That was the primary reason. Ah. We have a microphone.
Sure. Yeah, the reason we decided to use BB Bridge is because that's the one park that we have. We manage the camping at that one, gotcha. At that park, and we didn't want to, again, be working with state parks or other of our park managers to try and work through a pilot on this.
Makes sense. Thank you. Yep, I do remember that now. Sorry.
Andrew?
All right. Andrew Grissel, Manager, Energy Development Conservation. I'm providing an update on our electric vehicle charging station installation. As you saw a couple weeks ago, we unveiled the two charging stations here at the district. We will have the Walla Walla and Rocky Reach installations complete likely by the end of this week. Those are actively going in right now. And we're still working on the one at CTC Center. But we expect that by the end of the year as well. So those are going along well. Also, later today, there will be a resolution in front of you discussing the agreement with the North Central Washington Economic Development District and Plug-in North Central Washington, that is a party with underneath there, for the agreement to for them to purchase to be able to pay us for the electricity and offer those charging stations for free to the public. And so that will be coming later today.
For 3 years?
There's no end for it. There's been a dollar amount informally said that they'll provide, and that can last a long time because of just, you know, how the systems are used and how the vehicle charging stations are used. But we're expecting it to be 3 to 5 years, somewhere in there, that that funding will allow.
Well, how in the agreement, then, how would it sunset at some point?
There's termination clauses for both of us, for both entities. And so, either the utility or Plug-in North Central Washington can provide a termination notice. And then at that point, we would just go into, more of a, look at now we need to go out and get, purchase some payment type of system for them. But what this is doing is allowing us to put that off for some time.
Well, can't Chelan terminate?
We can.
Okay.
Yep.
But ultimately, with this, one thing that shouldn't be lost on, for the benefit of the public is we as a utility will never be in the business of providing free electricity.
Absolutely.
And Plug-in North Central Washington has really stepped up and made a big impact. But in perpetuity, if they can't, we'll have to do something different.
That's exactly right, yes.
Yeah, following along that line, I just got a question about, so when you're just going to give me a pass to use your pumps down here so I can get free gas. And it was really nice to be able to respond that there's an entity, an agency that will be covering the cost of the electricity provided, so no, we're not giving your electricity away, and nor are we going to give you our gasoline away. Right. But it was very pointed and it was very angry.
Yeah.
So it was nice to be able to dispel that with some humor and some understanding.
Yeah. No, if they had not stepped up, we would have put in some technologies that would have allowed payment.
Yeah.
And what we're doing is this allows us time to not only study it, which we would like to do, but also provide us with the time for some of those payment methods to mature and become even more user-friendly.
And Tesla owners do get free electricity at supercharging stations all around the country. So maybe there's some confusion there because all of theirs will be free.
They do. Tesla pays for that.
Right.
But, yeah.
And Teslas are cool, by the way.
Ours are not Tesla's charging stations.
Right, yeah, that's a big load in a short time.
Any other questions for Andrew? Okay, thank you, sir.
All right, good.
Andrew's also overseeing the utility infrastructure study, which involves identification of possible investments in fiber, water, and electrical infrastructure to potentially stimulate economic development. That work is underway. And the combined hydroenergy research and electrification research and collaboration study is a 2017 project. The Plains Substation Site Safety Improvements Project is going well. Discussions with key stakeholders, permitting and design of a parking area and river access are underway. Construction is expected to begin the spring of 2017.
Jeff, where are we? Okay, there we are.
Okay. Next one is the Regional Water Wastewater Study. There we go. And Ron Slaybaugh is back to report on discussions he's having with the cities of Cashmere and Leavenworth.
Morning again. I thought you'd take this one.
No, you were voted.
Fair enough. Just a quick overview. This proposal was jointly submitted by the cities of Leavenworth and Cashmere, requesting that the PUD evaluate regionalizing water and wastewater services. So we had discussions with the cities earlier this year and more specifically narrowed that to the PUD assuming ownership and operation of the city's water and wastewater utilities. No progress is made to date on this. We're planning for 2017. We're currently developing stakeholder engagement plan. We're looking to create some topic teams of folks that are representative of the communities that would benefit from this proposal. And essentially we would hire a qualified utility financial consultant next year to carry out this study. And this is an operational regionalization. It's not connecting all the facilities together with pipes or centralized treatment or centralized water source and distribution. Again, it's just more one entity overseeing the operations and management of all of the various utilities. There are several opportunities for efficiency here, and the goal is that we could, with any of the cost savings, with any value, we could pass that along to the customers with lower rates. One of the opportunities within the Wenatchee River, we are all required to meet the requirements of the TMDL, that pH and dissolved oxygen total maximum daily load study that Ecology passed back in 2009. And if we do that individually, of course, there's a set of costs associated with that. But by being able to tackle it as a group, looking at all three of the treatment plants, four, including Dryden, there might be some opportunities there to come up with something that's more sustainable and more cost-effective for everyone involved. So again, we're not a whole lot more activity for this year. We're just planning, and we'll be prepared to kick it off in 2017.
Thank you. Okay. Any questions for Ron?
Well, that plan would also include Lake Wenatchee, wouldn't it? Or not?
Well, sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're included because it's
right.
PUD, right.
Correct. Every PUD-owned system. So it's our Wenatchee Water System, Wenatchee Water, Olalla, Dryden, and Chelan Ridge, and our three wastewater systems, Peshawson, Dryden, and Lake Wenatchee, will all be included.
And just a comment, I've had several conversations with Mayor Gomes in Cashmere, and there's a keen interest in where this conversation goes. So this is a worthwhile study.
Excellent. Thank you for the feedback.
Yes. So the hard deadline by Ecology has been moved back.
Not to my knowledge.
So I thought we had some deadlines in 2017 we had to meet in terms of the wastewater, the TMDL, and
2019. Yeah.
So we're on the critical path.
We're still on track.
Are we? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there is that communication going on about seeking to modify the approach that Ecology is taking towards these systems. So we're trying to engage with them and
Are they engaging back?
Yes, they've been engaging back. I think we feel good about the fact that they understand some of the challenges that we're confronting here, both because of the TMDL, but also because of the funding issues that have come up with the state legislature and the challenges that we've seen in terms of increasing costs. So we've had those initial conversations saying, wow, this has changed from what we thought a couple of years ago. We need to think about where we take this. And the ball is in our court, actually take the next step to describe sort of what some of the options are and how we might be able to work together on that.
That's wonderful, because initially they said there's no, you know, there's no dollar figure that we, you know, in other words, we're not going to pay any attention to what this is going to cost you. This has to be done. So they've obviously softened their stance, their approach.
There's been some changes in staffing at a college.
Really?
Yeah.
Good.
And we'll see how this turns out. There's no commitment on their part yet other than to engage in a conversation.
Okay.
It may be they've just put velvet over that steel glove.
Never know.
Thank you, Ron. And the last report is on implementation of the utility-focused education program that will be provided by Lorna Klemanski.
And while Lorna's coming back up, I want to just go back to one for a second. The Hydro Energy Research Institute, there's been some really good work done by John Yale to develop a concept paper around an idea that we're intrigued with, which is there some way to be able to use the newly evolving sensor technology inside of our turbines so that we can better understand what's going on there rather than having to actually pull units out? So this is a long-term project. This is not something that would happen in the next 5 years even, because it would take the technology being ready at a time when we are ready to make modifications to our units. So it's probably in the 2020s if it were to come together. But we found that there's interest in the hydropower industry generally, and we're looking for other partners, Department of Energy and others, that eventually could pursue that.
Is there a prototype, or this is just something they're developing in the lab?
This is really a new thought that's not even being developed in the lab.
Oh, at this point, okay.
So, good morning. I thought I'd take an opportunity to let you know where we are with the education program. Originally, in the strategic planning task force, the plan talked more about mentorship and internship opportunities, and we've kind of determined that that would be pretty labor-intensive within the utility, and so we wanted to think about how we could do things that would be beneficial that wouldn't be so staff-intensive. So we've shifted our focus somewhat from providing mentoring and internship opportunities, and our work plan now is to hire a dedicated person to develop a program that will provide education opportunities and help develop them. That person will actually start on October 24th, and you might know that that's Mario Cantu, who has worked with us on the Diverse Leaders Group and some other things. We're also in the process of conducting a community needs assessment to guide our future efforts. We're going to develop a set of criteria and guidelines to facilitate district contributions of resources for those community education efforts. We're participating in the Apple STEM Network.
Quick question.
Yes.
I've seen STEM Lon. I know it's science, technology.
Engineering and math.
Engineering and math. Thank you.
Yeah. And my question is, are they also entertaining adding the other acronym for arts?
At this time, we hadn't, because we do need to remain within our authority. Mm-hmm. And so engineering and math, technology, science, those are all things that we do. Arts is not so much our mission.
Yeah. Do you mind if I speak to that for a second?
Sure.
In a recent second grade field trip to the Wenatchee Dome, which is considered to be the oldest geological formation in the area, second grade field trip, the single most attentive the second graders were was the music portion, which put to song the lessons and objectives of the day. And so the increase in learning by incorporating the arts throughout these projects is significantly higher and is a better investment than if it doesn't have that component in it. So I would urge us to look at that in terms of expanding for the public the best investment we can in terms of overall learning.
I'll take that under advisement and see as we're developing the curricula how that works.
And I use a second grade example, but you can follow it through research all the way through.
Okay, thank you. Also, we want to provide student learning work opportunities. So as I said, we're calling it the Education and Community Engagement Coordinator. We'll start next Monday. We've started the survey for the training needs assessment. We have those responses that we'll be collating those and doing some follow-up interviews this month. and then we'll compile all those results to report out. We're actually working with the Our Valley What's Next task force. And in mid-December, we'll develop an action plan for what we think we want to do in 2017. We do know already that we are adding a couple of additional student learning positions in 2017.
Any questions for Lorna?
That Sorry. Last item will be coming forward for your review as part of the budget.
Yeah, and please don't misconstrue my comment. This is long overdue, and I'm glad we're making progress on this. And I'm very happy as a commissioner, although I was a little growly a minute ago.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lorna.
I have an ask as long as Lorna's up here, if I may. I'm just curious where we are on the outreach to, or actually maybe not outreach, but working with our developmentally disabled adults in terms of employment at the PUD. And I know you've done some work on that, but I'm just wondering maybe as an ask if we could get a report on that at a future date.
Okay, yeah, I've had some interest in doing that, but it hasn't been on the work plan. So I'll get back to you on that.
We did, at your request, contact Mission Vista. Mission Vista?
Mm-hmm. Mission Sorry. Vista.
And found that we really didn't have much of a connection there, at least according to their program coordinator. So,
in terms of making something work
yeah.
for employment?
You had the contact, right?
Yeah, we did have another group that seemed like they had a more robust program to help support us in doing supported employment. And then our challenge was that we didn't have any positions that we could provide for disabled folks. So, we have to have positions in the utility that yeah. we can provide. So that was our challenge last year.
I remember that now. And Mission Vista is in kind of a trend, or has been going through a transition, and they have a new vocational person, and they're kind of getting back up to speed on vocational. But
that's good to know.
I just look around in the clinic and law offices and other federal agencies all employ developmentally disabled adults, so I just felt like there's got to be a way we can participate. But maybe we talk further offline. And
okay, yeah. Sounds great.
Okay, thanks, Lorna.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Lorna. So that is our report. We'll be back on the 21st of November with the two elements that remain, the Rocky Reach Visitor Count Study and the Splash Pad Technical Feasibility Study. And again, the fiber update will be coming as well. Any questions on any of the projects? By the way, the background documents for those two, number 9 and number 13, will be provided on the 21st, so you'll end up with a complete packet at that point. They're not there today.
Nice job on this.
Thank you. Well, great team working on this effort collectively. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
I'm just going to note, I have to admit that I've been a little bit surprised at the amount of time it takes to do all of these programs, and so we're definitely just struggling some with the amount of resource that we're putting into it. I underestimated the level of effort it would require.
Is that ultimately that time consumption on the part of our staff, is that factored into the cost here?
We are trying to do that. We're trying to track all the labor hours that are going into this so that will be available for you as information in your decision making.
Good. Phone replacements.
Okay. I ask Mike Coleman in particular to come up and lead a large group of folks here.
No, we're good. Good morning, Commissioners. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecommunications. Bob Shane, Director of Operations for Fiber and Telecommunications, and David Lodge, the Project Manager, are going to deliver this presentation. But I wanted to give an overview. This project has had a long and winding history, and therefore I wanted to provide kind of a summary at the beginning of the presentation. It goes back to 2011-2012 when a project was initiated to replace the existing legacy phone system, not replace it, but to upgrade it. And the reason for the upgrade was to obtain manufacturer support and warranty because the system was out of support. And given that it was coming out of preservation mode, the district, it was planned as a very low-cost upgrade just to obtain the manufacturer support. As the detailed analysis was done on that project, it became very clear that it was not in the best interest of the customer owners to pursue it any further. It was an extremely short-term project to gain that support, but technology was moving on, and so we would rapidly lose the manufacturer support. That was followed by initiating a project to look at a hybrid solution to go from the legacy technology to a full IP platform. That hybrid solution introduced new challenges to the process. It would provide a complete solution, but it took longer to implement, and it also started moving across different functional groups. It had an impact on the technology shop or the tech shop and the IT shop, and so at that point, we stopped it and did a lessons learned exercise. Bob Shane and Greg Larson, the director of the IT group, did the lessons learned, and Bob will cover that during his presentation. But one of the key lessons that was learned was that as technology changes, it tends to impact different functional groups, and often functional groups tend to grow up dealing with a specific technology, and when you start changing, you have to look at the interaction between the different work groups. So what we learned out of that, the key lesson, is that you really need, as technology changes, a multifunctional look at a project because you have to assess all of the costs, the different solutions, all of their costs, and the impacts amongst the various work groups. And again, Bob will cover that in a little bit more detail during the presentation. But where we came out of it is that we now have a true joint project between telecom and the IT group. Bob Shane and Greg Larson are leading this, and it puts us in a position to do a full IP platform replacement for the legacy technology. So it gives us the full capabilities, and it truly takes into account the impact to the different work groups, the different networks, and the different systems that are involved in delivering communications across the district. And with that, I'm going to let Bob and David go through the presentation and share with you not only the history, but the proposal and where we're at today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning, Commissioners. Bob Shane. I'm the Director of Fiber and Telecom, and with me I have David Lodge, who's the project manager for this particular effort. As Mike said, I'm going to provide a little bit of history. Hopefully won't give you a lot of detail that's unnecessary, but I think what's in the slides is quite a bit, but it does cover a lot of important things that I'd like to discuss with you. There's no board action required today, but we do plan to come back on November 7th and ask for a budget revision. David, you Thank you. So starting with why we want to replace some of this, you've heard from the previous presentations I've given you, but it's 13-year-old equipment. It's no longer supported by the manufacturer at all. There's not a single component that's supported by that manufacturer. Parts are difficult to find, although we can find them on eBay, and we've done that to some extent with some success, but as time goes on, those parts becoming more difficult to find, and there's an unknown status of those parts. We can buy them, but we're not convinced they're necessarily serviceable parts. And with that comes an increasing risk in failure of that system. This particular system is what we'll call the legacy technology, and for the purpose of this presentation, it's it's something that we're moving completely away from as we go to the IP, which is Internet Protocol solution that Mike had talked about. Project history, back in 2012 and even prior to that, we were looking at the shortcomings of the system in terms of support. We worked with the manufacturer and identified some very quick and easy upgrades that we could implement to get the system into partial support. Basically was upgrading some of the software and changing out some of the main processor boards in the system. The advantage of that was we kept the same system in place, and we just basically replaced some of the guts, and we didn't have to change anything on the outside, which lent itself a very quick deployment. We had to consider the trade-offs in there that we knew the support was relatively short because the manufacturer was transitioning from the legacy platform to the IP platform, so we knew it would just buy us a little bit of time. Some of the disadvantages, although you would think it'd be advantageous, is we could reuse some of the parts and components, but those very parts that we would reuse were becoming old and worn out. Desktop phones, some of you may have noticed that the display kind of flickers. Probably not nobody in this group because we pay special attention to that. But there are some of us that have conditions where the displays flicker, and it's a sign of contacts wearing out. The circuit boards have circuit cards, contacts are wearing out. So there's not a lot of value in that. Ultimately, we thought it'd be an overall higher replacement cost because those systems would eventually fail and we'd have to replace those, and there was no ability to do that. At that time, we budgeted $720,000 for the project. But through our deep dive, we realized, in summary, very short-lived situation or solution. Didn't provide the long-term reliability because it was a piecemeal replacement of the system. So at that point, we suspended the project, didn't spend any additional funding on it. We did put $100,000 for feasibility to go back and do some more studies, and we lowered the budget to $600,000 until we decided what we wanted to do. So that was one particular scope and one effort. We later on, in 2015, we knew we wanted to go to an IP solution, but again, working with the particular manufacturer, we saw that there was a technical and cost incentive to stay with that manufacturer and do a hybrid solution, meaning you would install a minimal amount of equipment to get it stable, and then through a scheduled deployment, it could be a year, two, or three, you could migrate to a full IP platform. The real value in that was we didn't have to do a forklift system change out. We could do it ad hoc or as needed as we went forward. So there were some benefits in that. Going along that process, we went ahead and procured a support contract to help us evaluate that, which is was issued under the RFP 1536. We did present to the board in January to move forward with that project. We had a revision of the project amount to $1,471,824. We are pretty comfortable with moving forward with that process, but we still had some last-minute things we were looking at. And ultimately, our final assessment, we did not support the hybrid solution. And on there, on the slides, there are a number of things that we, major points that we felt were key. The migration solution, although it made a lot of sense, there was some costs and technical incentives overall. It didn't meet our really overall technical and financial expectations. There was a lot of intricate workarounds to make it work. The manufacturer, and when we started out, saw a very clean path, but as we did our assessment, we saw a lot of challenges in what was being proposed. Although we could have made it work, it was not the most graceful solution. And overall, it took a longer integration process because of the workarounds. And then in April of 2016, we canceled that RFP. At that point, we stood back and really try to understand our misses in the long-term objective. We knew we wanted to go to an IP platform, but we didn't quite get there gracefully and timely as we had thought. So we went back and we did a lessons learned analysis, and we found out a couple of things that we wanted to apply going forward. One was to follow the district's developed engineering project management plan. There's already a very good platform in place. We followed it, but we didn't follow it as strictly as we should have. That's one of the reasons we brought on David into the program to help us manage that a little bit better. There are some district standards and best practices that we could have followed better. A lot of those were developed by IT, so we took a very much closer look at that. A big thing was the effect of collaboration, meaning that we went from a legacy system to the eyes of the telecom engineers, very comfortable with that platform and that era of technology, but we were moving to an IT platform or an IP platform with IT help. We took a different look. We had IT help us look the other direction to see where those risks and issues were, and together we realized that we had the best team if we work collaborative, and that was a big effort that we pushed through, and that was part of the I think recognizing the cycle of personal ownership, where each every member contributed as if it was their own project and not as if they're standalone projects. That became one of the issues we discovered earlier. So going forward, we wanted to make sure that we covered the things that we had missed before. So we wanted to establish clear expectations. I won't read them all, but basically make sure the group and all its members were on the same page with the same objective and the same desires and getting to the end. So we became a group, a whole group at that point instead of silos. And that was a big thing for us. So in the actions taken going forward from that point, I think the two big things for me was we carefully reviewed and applied what we had learned from the previous two attempts to get the project launched. We broadened our playing field and we expanded our evaluation to include solutions from the other manufacturers. And what I mean by that is the first two attempts, we were sticking with the original manufacturer because we saw there was value in there. But in doing that, it kept our options relatively limited in scope. Once we decided we wanted to move to the full IP platform, we no longer had to stick with that manufacturer. And so we broadened up our investigation, our review of other manufacturers. And once we did that, we saw the better solution because we broadened that up. And that was a big deal for us. We went ahead and, again, we assured that we had a joint relationship with the IT and the telecom group to make sure we're working together. As part of that process, we evaluated four telephone solutions, of which we gained access to competitive pricing and a much shorter procurement schedule, staying with a state contract. And we compared those detailed scopes and pricing between the two top vendors, and ultimately we selected Cisco as the solution and CompuNet as the integrator. They had worked together previously. We did a deep dive analysis of their ability to complete the job, and we found them to be quite qualified to help us out and assist in the project. So the new scope project, again, we had the first one, which was just simply an upgrade. The second one was a hybrid solution. The new scope now is a complete rip and replace, if you will. We're going to implement a full IP platform. The challenge there is immediate shift in paradigm. We're moving from the old system, which was old technology, old wiring, and now we're going to switch to the new system. So all the things you need to do to make that system viable, you have to do up front. So we had some extra work to do that. The value and benefits of going with the IP platform, I won't read them all here, but basically I think the big top ones is portability. When I talked about the original system, if you can picture this, we had 10 nodes that were distributed throughout the district's facilities. These are pieces of equipment about the size of a apartment-sized refrigerator, the dedicated piece of equipment, power supplies. The whole systems were self-contained at these different locations. The new system is essentially a computer, if you will. And so we ride on the network that the IT system already has in place. And so we no longer have monolithic systems sitting out there. It's virtualized. And so it makes our portability of the system very easy, which means when you add and remove, turn up a new facility, it's very quick and easy to implement that solution instead of having to put a dedicated piece of hardware there. The other part of it is industry standard. Again, IP or internet protocol is a very standardized infrastructure and protocol, well understood and supported. This system is that by 100%. There are some notable requirements we have to do because of the paradigm shift. One is a heavy dependency in the IT shop, but Greg and I have talked through that. We're on the same page in making this successful for the district and customer owners. There's some make-ready work that needs to happen. That work was there previously, but we could do it ad hoc. Now we're going to have to do it all at one time, and that's basically bringing some wiring standards back up to industry standards. And the other thing that's different is the old system being a monolithic type system. It was centralized in the sense that you could put power systems in to support those devices. Now that it's distributed, we have to move power out in a distributed way instead of a centralized way, so it adds a little complexity and cost to the project. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to David to give you some overview on what the system will actually provide when we're completed.
Thanks, Bob. David Lodge, project manager. So as Bob mentioned, this is a IP-based system, so it resides on our corporate network, and I could tell you all about how that makes it highly reliable, redundant, recoverable, but those are all expectations you should have of this new system. So today I want to focus on a couple of features that are going to provide immediate benefits to our district staff and to our customers. Before I go on, I want to point out that we're still in the process of configuring the system, so I'm going to tell you about the tools that are available to us, but not specifics of how they will be configured in the end. So for our customers, we're going to have a new advanced call center, which allows for the most efficient routing of calls to the most appropriate staff resource, and that can be skills-based, so routing calls based on language or a specific customer need. And I don't want you to think this means we're going to create a barrier for our customers with interactive voice response or auto attendance. It's quite the opposite. We want to get calls to the staff as quickly as possible so they can answer our customers' needs. But with our new advanced call center, we'll enable different types of interactions through email or chat, because not everybody wants to have their questions answered over the phone. Also, it's based on a web-based platform, and what that means is it gives us the best positioning for a future integration with our future CIS system. And also, there will be advanced reporting tools, which will allow for all kinds of metrics tracking for our customer accounting folks and allow them to maintain their already high level of customer service.
So when somebody calls, are they going to get a person automatically?
They will get a person.
Okay.
Very good.
That's important.
In all of our outreach that we've done, that has been clear across the board that we have people answering the phones. But this system is not just about phones. Phones are part of the overall project. And what's really exciting is with this residing on the corporate IT network, it's almost like the phones become an extension of everyone's computer. So there's new integration opportunities that weren't available before. And this broad range of capabilities is called unified communications. And some of the ways we plan to deploy that will be presence. So knowing if somebody is available before you make a phone call based on their calendar or their actual position of their phone. There's instant messaging available. Click to call, where a phone number is a hyperlink, and you click it, and it makes the phone call for you. Web conferencing, desktop file sharing, other video integration possibilities. We're not going to roll that out right off the bat, but we'll be video integration ready. Also, mobility integration. The system will think of smartphones as an extension of the system. So rather than just forwarding a call to your phone, it'll treat it like a part of the system where you can transfer calls and actually move calls back and forth from a fixed device to a mobile phone. And then also unified messaging, getting all of our messages in one location. So all kinds of opportunities for productivity tools that weren't available until this technology. There's lots of other enhanced features. We're replacing our voicemail system. We're replacing our conference bridging. We'll have new call recording to cover the call recording that we currently have as a district policy. New switchboard attendant consoles, making it easier for our switchboard attendants to get calls to people who need to take them. Emergency responder, which is a program that actually provides a granular location information to security and to first responders based on the location of the switch and device. And then it opens us up for all kinds of future integration with possibilities of automated emergency response or emergency notification or radio integration and all kinds of other products that are available to reside on an IP type system.
Thank you, David.
So before you go the schedule and the timeline, cybersecurity issues that potentially emerge with a reliance on this, do we open up any additional risk in the cybersecurity arena?
Absolutely, which is why we're working very closely with the IT security department to make sure that this provides the same security that we currently have on our business network.
Yeah, I would further qualify that it's going to be as secure as the IT network is, and the IT does a very good job now as part of our assessment, looking at it all the time. And so this really doesn't create any additional risk. It's whatever risks on the IT network is what we're going to have to deal with. Now, there are some specific areas that we're working on with the control systems group, where they have concerns about using an IP phone in their work environment, but that's something that's being socialized. We're working with that group to make sure we fully identify the risks and making sure we put things in that mitigate any concerns that they have and resolve any issues that they have. But we are very much aware of it, and we are very much watching it as we go forward.
And we're putting together a presentation for the board on overall cybersecurity risks that we expect to bring to you in the next couple of months.
So if we can move on to the schedule, in 2016, we want to complete the design and the implementation process or design with CompuNet, which is the integrator, and Cisco, which is the manufacturer. As I mentioned before, we have some wiring upgrade efforts that we have to do. We're doing that systematically to make sure that we roll out that correction before we deploy the phone system. And as we should, we continue stakeholder engagement to make sure we're not missing the needs of our clients. 2017, we will actually make the purchase of the Cisco system under the state contract. We'll start the deployment and testing the new system in 2017. Obviously, there's user training that needs to go on, so we're going to put something pretty extensive in that because it will be completely different than anybody else who's used here in the district. There's a flashover cut, and if you recall earlier, I was talking about the hybrid solution, and under that scope, there would not be a hard flash cut. This will be different. This will take place most likely over a weekend where you shut down your old phone on a Friday and come into Monday, and you have the new system up and running.
For the entire utility? And,
yes, sir. And then the results of that, removing the old equipment, which is the monolithic equipment, all the phone, desk phones, and so forth. And the wiring that we currently have that supports that system will become obsolete and pull it out if we need to. Otherwise, it stays there until we demolish the building or move on to the next thing. So the cost estimates for this, total system replacement is $1,821,000. That includes end-to-end, that's the phone system, it's the wiring that we're talking about that needs to be corrected. The additional backup power that I mentioned earlier is now an issue. Unified communication, which David talked about, and the typical project management along with a 15% contingency. So next steps, we'd like to come back to the commissioners on November 7th and ask for a budget revision of $1,221,000. I'm sorry. Yes. $1,221,000. Sorry about that. Our current approved budget is $600,000. And as I mentioned before, the revised budget amount was $1,821,000.
So you would anticipate, based on this request, you would anticipate this system being in place before the end of the year?
End of 2017.
Well, this is 17.
Yes.
So
16, we're still doing the evaluation. 17 is when we'll actually do the, can you go back to the.
So why would it require a budget revision if it's 17?
We're trying to get that approved prior to the normal budget process, but we want to get moving on this.
Okay.
A couple weeks is a lot for us.
You IT guys are all the same.
Are there any questions? There's a lot of information there.
It's a good presentation.
Thank you.
More of a compliment than a question. And I had included it in a feedback to General Manager Steve Wright. To one point, just stopped and said, let's take a look at using our lessons learned protocol and going back and doing the thorough revision. I think speaks really highly to a healthy organization. And because sometimes personal investment can get to a point where other decisions get made. In this case, it seems like there was a shedding of that and a going in a higher prioritization of the project and perhaps a better way to look at it. And to me, it's just absolutely commendable that there are processes in place that would cause us to move forward in that process. So thanks to everybody and the willingness to do that. And I think we're going to have a better system.
Thank you for your feedback on that. It was a difficult decision, not because it was clear we wanted to do something different, but it's difficult to actually come to that conclusion when you've done all your homework and you felt very comfortable with it. And then when you get to the end of it, you go, we don't think that's the right thing.
Maybe not. Maybe. Yeah. So thank you very much.
Thank you for that feedback.
Yeah, that's a confidence builder.
Commissioner Arsenault.
I just want to say that much like Commissioner Smith, I think this is a wonderful move forward, although I am very concerned about the cybersecurity issues. And as we shift our telecommunications capability onto the Internet, we certainly have to be aware of the vulnerabilities that creates. In preparation for today's meeting, I spent some time over the weekend researching just that point and came across a rather lengthy document, draft written by Columbia University on this very topic. And after I read the 13 pages of it, I was scared to death. So I would just echo Commissioner Smith's concerns that the cybersecurity portion of this is something that we really have to nail down and know for sure that we're...
I'd agree with that very much, and we are looking at that. Just a point of clarification, it's Internet protocol is what we're using for the transport, but the phone system itself within the district stays within the district, but it's running over that protocol. When the calls are placed outside of the corporation, it travels the network as any other phone traffic would be, but the internal call between the commissioners, between you and I, stays internal to the district system in that sense. Just to add a little clarity there.
Thank you. Thank you. I think the concern is that as long as our walls are up and they're not vulnerable, then we're fine. Yeah.
I may have mentioned this before, but there's a great book out entitled Lights Out by Tom Brokaw. That's a really good reading and also scares you to death. Lights Out.
Thank you for those comments, and we will take that very seriously.
Any other questions? Any question from any member of the public?
I'd like to finish with one thought, if I could. I appreciate Commissioner Bowles' your comments. I want to call out in particular Mike Coleman, Bob Shane, Greg Larson for making a really good decision a year ago. Let's stop. It's a corollary to our stop work authority that we say every employee has. If something's not going right, let's stop and let's take a look. And it is hard to do that when you're in the middle of a project, especially when you've already been to the board and asked for approval to move ahead.
Yeah.
But it was definitely the right choice. And this is another place where best for the most for the longest is really serving as well, because that was the question that was on the table is, are we really making the best decision for the most people for the longest period of time? Mm-hmm. And we feel like we're in much better shape than that with the work that's been done.
Mm. Yeah. It's a sign of strength, not weakness.
You don't think that at the time, though.
No, it certainly doesn't feel that way.
So we've made that mistake in the past in a very big way, where we didn't stop when we had a lot of questions and uncertainty and kept going. And so, yeah, I'm thrilled to see the change of the approach and kind of the attitude within the district that it's okay to say, wait a minute, let's stop. This isn't looking right.
Thank you.
Good work.
You bet.
Well, I'm just going to weigh in here and just kind of do a down-to-earth thing here. Anything worth doing is worth doing right.
Mm-hmm.
And so thank you. I agree with everything that's been said here. So.
Thank you.
All right.
No other questions?
Thank you very much. Okay. 2016 Board Balance Scorecard Status Report. Got President Smith on there. I don't know who that is, but I did go over these documents this morning with Sheila before the meeting, and it does not appear that we have any items that are not being handled appropriately
within the appropriate time frame. There's three items on the balance scorecard that are actually four that are currently white, but they are, after looking at them, I don't know that we even need to talk about those individually. One item that I did bring up to Sheila, we talked about in the other list that we, I'm not sure where it is, the list of meetings that we all got online that aren't here before us, it came to my attention that we probably, as a commission, need to help Sheila out in providing her more information on meetings that we're doing that we're not getting reported. And it came to me because I've been monthly attending a Kashmir Economic Development Committee meeting as a representative of the PUD, and I haven't been submitting that as a list of the meetings we've been doing. Gary, I think you're probably, you've had some water meetings that aren't being submitted. And in order to capture the essence of what we're doing outside of regular board meetings, we as commissioners probably need to set up some type of a, I won't call it a protocol, but a system to make that happen. Sheila?
This happens to be what you're talking about?
Right, right. You know, we've had under responsible board representation and attendance at special meetings, workshops, subcommittees, and other public meetings, open public meetings. So just a reminder, I reminded myself this morning, and I remind any of you, if it doesn't get captured here, we don't get a good picture for us and for the public of all the things that we're involved in and activities that we're doing to represent the utility on a countywide basis. Other, anybody, you know, feel a need to have additional comment on our balanced scorecard at this time? Recognizing, like I said, there are those four white that ultimately we have covered and are in the process of covering, whether it be budgetary or our board training, which we did do with Michael Nash and are going to have further discussion potentially this winter with our board workshop.
Maybe I was going to bring it up during commissioner items, but it might be a more appropriate time to bring it up now. Commissioner Arzenau and I were involved in the WAPUTA budget meeting, and there was some discussion during our workshop related to dues, how often they're assessed, you know, what the status is of that. And so, you know, with your permission, I think it can kind of clear up a few questions that maybe we had floating at that point. Dues are assessed every 2 years, and that assessment was just done. And that's based on our submitting to the state association the number of water customers we have, sewer customers we have, electric customers we have, plus our telecom revenue. And so that creates a composite in terms of what our dues then will be assessed on. We're also, this organization is capped at the maximum level in terms of what our dues can be. The result is, for the next 2 years, we will have I think it's a $47 reduction in our dues over the next 2 years. So if that helps in terms of planning the budget for what our dues are going to cost in the commissioner's budget, I can give you that, you know, number at appropriate time. The other thing that comes up, interestingly, almost every budget meeting is, so when are we going to start including wholesale sales as a means of assessing dues? And I will have a conversation with Mr. Wright, but it was a general manager on the executive committee who asked that question. And at some point, I think we need to politely respond to that this organization with in-kind contribution probably exceeds the value of what wholesale sales would do. And so my opinion as a commissioner is, don't ask us to do both. Don't ask us to report our wholesale sales and cause us to create a budget and then continue at the level of participation that we have for our staff at state association meetings, because I think if we recovered our cost, it would probably be more expensive to the state association than if they just didn't include wholesale sales as part of the dues.
Of course, we're already capped, aren't we?
We are capped, but if you add, if you change that cap and add in wholesale sales, it pushes our dues up. But yet at the same time, this organization contributes more to state association meetings and to education that is sponsored throughout our employees in the state to all the PUDs, of which we just simply cover those costs. So I think if you look at the cost of covering those and the cost of what it would be, we're probably better off. The association is probably better off not to do the wholesale sales and just let it ride. But I want to have that conversation because it's a prevailing view that comes up from some direction every time there's a budget meeting.
I have a question. Looking at that going forward, I mean, there's only a few utilities that actually would be affected by that. Yeah. And so the motive to do this, is it because they need more revenue at Waputa to operate, or is it to reduce the current dues paid by all members?
It seems to be, and I'm making an assumption, yeah, which could be foolish on my part, but it seems to me that it creates a fairness issue. Where people are looking at it going, well, it's not fair. You have your customers, but then you've got your outside sales.
Yeah, but what's the ultimate goal then?
I think a reduction in budget, a reduction in dues, okay, for the other
smaller
utilities.
But when you look at that, you also put the smaller utilities are put at a greater risk to the bigger utilities in staying unified and those kinds of things. So my point is, if one utility leaves for some reason, then that's going to be hugely impactful on the organization as a whole.
Correct.
When you do that.
Correct.
So are they aware of that risk as well?
Sometimes.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe this is a good topic for a workshop.
Yeah. But I just thought it had come up as a question during our workshop, and I just thought there was some clarification that we could add in, that our dues will remain the same for 2017 and 18.
So this is Deborah Vaughn, Strategic Financial Planning Analyst. Just send that on to Sheila, and she can send that to me. I can update your budget and your forecast.
Okay.
So, and if there is any decisions made about that change, make sure that I'm aware of that so I can adjust your forecast out if it's going to change significantly.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's a big reduction. Thanks. I think of $40 now.
Thank you. Okay. Do you have any manager items that you want to cover before lunch?
Yeah, I would, actually. In fact, I think since we got a little bit of time, I was going to try to do that. And I thought I also might cover the action items from the last meeting, just so we get our way, because we've got a very busy afternoon.
This one doesn't have.
So, Kimberly Craig's got the manager item.
This one doesn't have the dues.
Good morning, Commissioners. Kimberly Craig in Communications. Just wanted to give you an update on two upcoming events. The first one will be the finale event at Rocky Reach Dam. That's the fall harvest roundup on Sunday, October 30th from 1 to 4. We hope and are expecting about every school-age child in Chelan County to attend. There'll be treats, but there's a lot of hands-on learning at that as well, and we get really good responses from parents as well. They're also looking for volunteers, so if any of you have any volunteer connections for that 4 hours on that Sunday afternoon, 3 hours on that Sunday afternoon, they could really use help. And then also, I just wanted to give you a heads up on the third and final workshop session in the three-panel discussion at the Greater Wenatchee Area Technology Alliance. Chelan County PUD and the Technology Alliance have been working together on programs that highlight the global benefits of public power. The third and final workshop is November 9th at 11:30 back at the Confluence Technology Center, and it is on energized living and working in NCW, and it ties directly to our mission and vision for enhancing the quality of life in Chelan County. Ray Height will be on the panel talking about PUD parks, And we'll also have a program linked to the Sage Hills and our connection with wildlife up there. Kelly Cordell will have a display during that time. So I hope you can come.
Thank you.
Did want to walk through the action items from last meeting. So the substation timeline update, there was a request for that, and we're doing it at this meeting. We'll be doing it this afternoon. So it would be both on the North Shore and on Leavenworth. The rule of thumb relationship for natural gas prices has been provided to you by email. Key budget assumptions for the health care increase will be coming forward at the November 7th budget presentation. The question about what contacts were made with the county in reference to the high density loads, and you received an email from Andy Wendell about that. And then there was a question about the $54,000 to $68,000 sunk cost associated with the I can't remember the name of the term. Kirk, help me out. The turbine, the small turbines.
The attraction water turbines.
Attraction water
turbines. Rock Island.
Right, yeah. So Kirk gave you an email on that as well, so you should have all of those. Actually, the one I'm not sure of, and I think we didn't get to, because we did some back and forth internally, and I don't think we got to a conclusion, was how conservation affects the load forecast.
Right, we did not get that.
You did not get that. Okay, yes, so we still owe you that one, so we'll carry that over for the next meeting.
But I do want to thank, one, Dennis, for bringing that question up on the relationship of gas to electricity, and two, for your response, because, and I've altered it in my mind, because basically the ratio is 9-to-1 or in that neighborhood, and I emailed Steve back and said 10-to-1 is much easier to remember, so, you know, $5 gas is 5-cent electricity, you know, $3 gas is 3-cent electricity.
Interestingly, because about 6 years ago,
yeah.
I remember it was 8-to-1.
It was.
They gave us that rule of thumb back then.
Yeah,
and it will change through time.
Yeah,
you know, it's a function of what the gas units are that are operating on the margin at any time period.
Yeah, and the other piece that will change over time too is the number of renewables coming in.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that's very helpful to have that number, because it's a conversational number that people can understand, because they'll say, well, what's driving these prices? So then you can give them that, and it's like, okay.
So. That all your items?
It is. I don't know if you'd like to go through the commissioner items.
Well, we've got 15 minutes. Commissioner items, since we've moved away from doing a laundry list of reports, just a significant items, Commissioner Congdon.
I'll just do one very quickly. I attended the Distributed Energy Resources Conference in Spokane last week, and it was terrific. It's the first time NWPPA has sponsored this and presented this. And so had I known, I would have encouraged more Chelan staff to attend. We had terrific presenters from California, because you know where we're going with distributed energy resources in California. So let me just start by saying distributed energy resources includes solar, wind, batteries, microgrid, you know, a whole host of those are all distributed energy resources considered under that umbrella. So I will be able to download the PowerPoints from NWPPA. They're not up yet, or I would have brought them today, but I'll download, and almost all of them are really, really worthwhile. So I'll download those, and I'll send them to all of you. I'm sure you'll be interested. But I'll tell you, I was, my aha moment for this whole thing was that solar, and you know this, I'm sure, but the price of solar has really, really come down. It's so much more efficient. And there are some really large commercial solar arrays, solar installations that are 4 to 6 cents a kilowatt hour.
Hmm.
Does that shock you? That shocked
That's
me.
Big.
Does that
big.
Include the firming capacity?
No.
See, there's another cost there. You have to figure in with that.
But that's, and I asked, is that subsidized? And they said no. Some of them are not subsidized. I mean, there are lots of rebates and investment tax credits and so forth.
Yeah,
you know what? I want to ask. I'm going to ask that question, Carnan. Yeah. I'm going to ask that question. I'm not sure, because you would think when they give you the full, when they give you the cost of solar, that they would increase that. I mean, would include that, but well, I don't know.
They won't.
I wouldn't think so, but I'm going to check on that. But it was a terrific conference. I learned a ton. I will get PowerPoints to you guys.
I just think it's important that we don't send out the wrong impression that, you know, solar's 4 cents to distribute it, and and putting it on the grid.
I think
because along with that generation, there has to have backup generation that costs quite a bit more than that.
I think most people know that today, that solar requires firming up. But
it's always good to reiterate.
I'll ask if they have that number.
Yeah, because that could very easily more than double the cost.
Yeah, it could.
Other commissioner items? Gary?
Just reiterating what we talked about earlier with respect to the WPUTA budget meeting. I did have an opportunity to attend as well, and found it to be very fascinating, the process, very streamlined. And I thought that the process itself went very well. And I think the board will have a really good budget to vote on.
Yeah. Historically, it's much better than what it used to be. I have nothing.
Well, I've got one thing, or a couple things. Number one, last week, I think it was, Ann and I attended the second annual festival on Methyl Park in Wenatchee. I'm not sure what the title of that festival was. I just know it's the second annual. And it's sort of
kind of a neighborhood.
It's a neighborhood deal. And
in Spanish.
Hispanic outreach, trying to come together as a community, bringing leaders together. So I showed up there early and walked through their exhibits. They had just a few exhibits there, a few booths. And I thought it would be very important because of the questions that I received there from talking to everyone, that it would have been nice to have a Chelan presence there, Chelan PUD present, set up a little even if it's just for a couple hours, because people had a lot of questions asked, and it would have been an excellent opportunity to outreach the Hispanic community in this drive that they actually are, you know, initiated, and that is to bring the populations together. And so I thought it was really worthwhile. I enjoyed myself. They had entertainment. Everything was free.
Free food.
Yeah, and so it was a fun event to attend.
Can I jump in here?
Yeah, go ahead.
Gustavo, I know his last name. I'll get you the contact person. I'll get you his name. No, it's not Gomez, no. He's the CEO of El Mundo. Gustavo. Oh, sorry.
I can't remember his name, but his wife is Norma Gallego.
Yes, that's his wife.
Oh, okay. Gustavo would be, or
Norma would be your contact person.
Anyway, I thought it was, I just, you know, the questions that I was fielding, it would have been nice to, you know, say, okay, we can answer those questions. There was all kinds of questions about fiber, just different things about what the PUD is doing. I got sent on a wild goose chase. Apparently, somebody had fiber that, you know, I guess I got a hold of Mike and trying to track down if they had availability or not, but they already had it to their house. So, I mean, there is a communication thing that needs to be dealt with. But anyway, second.
May I jump in before you move?
Oh, yeah. I didn't get the right phone number to be,
yes,
be
so,
honest.
Yes, so one thing that struck me, that this was in Methyl Park, which is very close to downtown Wenatchee, a little to the south. And there's a big concrete central area that has a drain in the middle. And I looked all around to see if there were any, and I knew there weren't, but, you know, any spigots or any place where the water could come up. That would be the ideal place to have a splash pad for these folks when it's 100 degrees out. But, I mean, we don't own the property, so we probably can't do anything about
it.
But I'd love to see a community project, a neighborhood, you know, figure out a way to write a grant or do something to provide. Yeah, what they do is they have a hose. They hook up a hose and a sprinkler. But that would be so ideal, thinking of you, Dennis, for a splash pad, right?
Yeah, well, I'm a, you know, coronary patient, so I'm just kind of recovering here.
Well, I just might add, Mayor Coons was there, and he did speak to the folks and indicated there's money going to be appropriated to the park, you know, to try to improve it. One other thing here before I... I actually kind of sat in two roles last week as well, because I sit as a commissioner of Shasta Water District, and we invited Ron Slayball up to do an analysis of that water system someday in some fashion be incorporated with the PUD. And so this is just for public knowledge. At the appropriate time, I will recuse myself of any of the decisions or any of the negotiations going forward. This was just an initial what-if type of a conversation. So I just for full disclosure that I'm sure Eric will let me know when I need to back out. So that's it.
Sheila. Oh, you just gave it to
me. We just found it.
Okay.
This came to me.
You know, I actually only have a couple items. Looking back, I had a meeting that I don't think I've had before, and maybe you have, the state auditor, before they come in to audit the utility, request a one-on-one meeting with the board, I think usually the board president, just to have a few questions to set the stage for their audit of everything that we are doing. And just wanted to let my fellow commissioners know that I did have that meeting, answered a few questions, and hopefully started the audit process, you know, going in a right direction. So that's just sort of a little update. Looking out, I know there's been a certain level of interest here in the utility over the last few years of my ongoing activities in Kyrgyzstan, and as a result of the travel that we just had in September to Kyrgyzstan, I've scheduled a meeting or a presentation at noon on November 10th for our auditorium, which has been recommended doing a noontime presentation. Sometimes we'll gather more people in than an evening presentation. And so we've scheduled the auditorium to do a presentation on Kyrgyzstan here at the utility November 10th. That's do have another one for a Rotary meeting that same week, but thought we'd wait till after all of the other high-profile activities that are going on that will wrap up on November 8th, called the election, get that out of the way, and then get back to a little more sane presentation. Any other commissioner comments? Probably looks like a good stopping point, and recess for lunch and come back at 1 o'clock.
Commissioners, I'll be checking in with you over the lunch hour about particularly the Alcoa presentation, probably towards the end of the lunch hour.
Good afternoon. I'd like to call the afternoon session of the Chelan Public Utility District Commission meeting to order. Today's October 17th. We met this morning in a study session. This afternoon is a business session. We have a very full agenda. It's great to see the room full. I know there's some topics of great interest for a large number of people. And I think we may be finding a few more chairs, and that'll be good. As I shared this morning, if today on the items that come before us, there's a desire on the part of the audience to provide input to the commission, we ask that you come to the table here at the front, use the portable microphone, state your name and address for the record as our meetings are recorded, and we welcome your input. Do like to have that input, so please feel free to do that. I would like to make one correction from this morning's session that I put on the record. I mentioned to the folks that were here at the end of the meeting that there's going to be a public presentation on Kyrgyzstan. In our Chelan auditorium, I stated the date incorrectly this morning. The date is November 15th at noon in the auditorium, and we should have close to an hour for our presentation, maybe 45 to 50 minutes, and hoping to get anybody that wishes to come see that presentation. One other item, if any of you, with one exception, have your cell phones on, I ask that you silence them. We have one person that needs to take a call, and she's already asked about that, and that's fine if it rings. But it really helps us out not to have phones ringing during the course of the meeting. So this afternoon, first item on our agenda is the consent agenda. What is the wish of the commission?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept the consent agenda as presented.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda as it was presented. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. We go now to item 9 on our agenda. And by the way, for those in the room this morning, we did move item 15, the Alcoa update, up to right below number 9. So it will be the second item on the agenda. It'll be next after item 9, North Shore Lake Chelan Community Member Substation Siting Report.
Thanks, Commissioner. John Stoll, Managing Director, Customer Utilities. I do have a bit of a quick substation process update, and then I would like to invite up a couple community members from the North Shore Chelan area. Community group has been agreed to help us try and find more sites up there, but just briefly where we're at with the process. We have a public meeting coming up on the 2nd. I believe that's a Wednesday. That's the Leavenworth community meeting. I believe it's been scheduled for the fire hall up there at 5:30 because the city has quite a bit of business going on that day, so they moved the location. But that'll be an opportunity to look at those three sites that we've worked with the community on and have a bit more detail around that, some high-level renderings, some cost analysis among those three varying sites. On the Lake Chelan area, we still continue to look for properties. And with that, as I mentioned, we gladly accept any help from the community. And graciously enough, community members Michael Gibb and Carolyn Glossinger have driven down today to give us just a report back to the staff and the commission on how those efforts have gone. So with that, I'd like to invite them up.
Thanks, John.
It is on.
Great. Thank you. My name is Michael Gibb. My wife, Sue, and I live at 610 Boyd Road, which is located, for those of you that are familiar with it, in the areas 9-10 that were evaluated for the North Shore substation site. I made a commitment to John Stoll and to Chad Risman to follow up on at least two alternative areas and with two other property owners, and I wanted to give you a report on what I found there. First, going north and northwest up by Area 14, I was able to contact and have a extensive discussion with landowner Kyle Cotter. Mr. Cotter and his wife own property adjacent to the juncture of the upper and lower transmission lines, right near Area 14. In discussion with Kyle, it turns out that the spot that I had shown to Chad and to John and the location that I believe Steve Vaughn and Gary Wright Rice had looked at, it has Lake Chelan reclamation piping right through the spot that we thought would be optimal for the North Shore substation siting. So ran into sort of a dead end there on that follow-up. As a side note, I would say that while discussing things with Mr. Cotter, he fully endorsed the proposed site, which it would be on the Chelan Heights Orchard property. So here is an adjacent landowner who was telling me that he thought that agrarian site would work out very fine if we're able to proceed with good pre-engineering and cost analysis studies. The other commitment I made was to follow up with Mr. Otis Henderson, who is the landowner that owns the property of the site in area number 8 of a couple years ago, an area that has been taken off the table for various reasons. In what I think is area 7, along Henderson Road, I identified a site, showed it to both John and Chad, and wanted to follow up with Mr. Henderson, the landowner, on that potential site. However, I also made a commitment to the other folks within my neighborhood group who live on Henderson Road that I wouldn't contact the landowner, Mr. Otis Henderson, if the members of our neighborhood group were against looking further at that parcel. Unfortunately, we do have at least one landowner that is feeling very contrary to, you know, looking at that particular parcel in Area 7 at this point. But I did take pictures of the site. I forwarded them to John Stoll. And even though I don't feel I can follow up with Otis Henderson at this point, you know, perhaps somebody else can. Lastly, I don't know if anybody from Chelan PUD has investigated the area near and around the Chelan Golf Course. The reason I bring this up is that if, as a community / Chelan PUD partnership, we are able to proceed with something in Area 14, the Chelan Heights Orchard area, which would be farther north of the theoretical blue line, the load line, then perhaps something south of the theoretical load line, the blue line, between that point and the hospital substation would make sense. In investigating the area around the golf course, the Chelan Municipal Golf Course, there's property within the golf course, and there is property to the east and southeast of the golf course that I have identified adjacent to the transmission lines and not developed and not adjacent to a residential area. And so I would just end my comments by saying I would invite Mr. Steve Wright or John and Chad to come back up and let's go take a look. Perhaps there's some property owned by the city of Chelan up there that is not residential yet, and perhaps it would give us an opportunity in advance to purchase another parcel that would serve further development and growth in advance near the golf course. So those are my remarks. Any questions for me at all?
I just want to say thank you for the time you've spent. Thanks a lot.
We'll continue to be involved.
Carol. Hi, I'm Carolyn Lossinger. I live on 490 Boyd Road, a couple of doors down from Michael in Chelan. My reason for being here is I have walked along with Michael, and my husband and I have been driving around trying to find sites as much as Michael has. I also promised Chad and John to keep looking along with Michael that same day. And I told them I have a group of ladies that I have coffee with every Monday morning. And I've been picking their brains. And, of course, with women, you get a little more emotion. So the women in my coffee group are perplexed that, and I know you've heard it, but they want me to bring it up again. Why are you not trying to put this thing? I understand, Chad, the power pulls, but they want the substation down by the lookout, down by Crystal View, over by the reserve. These guys are your power drains, and you have a person in your comments, Nancy Redden, I think is her last name, who made a comment in the comment things about, well, once it's in there, nobody will care. And the other comment she made that stuck with me and with the ladies is property value. All we're concerned about is our property value. Well, Carl's and my comments, Section 910's area of people, we're not only concerned about our property value. Yes, that's important. We pay a lot of money to live in Chelan. We pay taxes. But there's animals, there's vegetation, there's wells. And in 910, that hits us hugely. So you've got the lookout. You've got a storage shed facility down there, and the ladies, and it's numerous, over 20, would love to see you pursue down there. I know it's not ideal, but nothing's coming up ideal. And as I was talking with Ann Congdon before this meeting, Carol and I, young version of us, used to watch Heaven Can Wait multiple times. In that movie, the lead character took over a guy's company and said, let's be ahead of the game. Let's not try and put something where it shouldn't be, where we're going to ruffle feathers, like Pagelsham was the town that this other woman came from. And he said, let some other company who wants to deal with lawsuits, problems, all sorts of other things, put it in the wrong place. We're going to be ahead of the game before we put the first shovel in the ground. I'm going to ask, please let's try and be ahead of the game and put the shovel where it should be, not where it's going to hurt somebody's property value, water, land, animals, etc. So, any questions?
I'd just like to say, Carolyn, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate the time you and Mike have spent both on this project. And I think it's pretty clear from our perspective here in the commission that we really do want to reach out and have you involved in this process. And but also to kind of help us narrow this down. I mean, because we are trying to do the right thing here. We're trying to, you know, have a process that people are involved. And for our perspective, we need to have this narrowed so that we can make a good decision. And that's why we've asked you to do this, and you volunteered. And I appreciate the time. It seems like you are going out and doing this. Thank you very much. But also keep in focus that, you know, we need to narrow this down to an area or a couple sites, 3, 4, something that we can start to evaluate. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I understand that narrowing down, mm-hmm. Totally. But again, in the process of narrowing down, as Chad had mentioned about not wanting to look at down by the lookout because of having to get lines under there, isn't it possible, you know, you talk about your creative ways, this is again the ladies, you talk about your creative ways to disguise this substation. Mm-hmm. You have creative ways at your hand, and we're appreciative for what you can do, but can't there be a creative way to get it from the lookout area down there under roadways or whatever you have to do, poles, without the huge impact to like an area 910? I don't understand, and neither do the ladies. I'm going to just speak for myself. You have a site 14, something in 14 that's workable. Why are you not pursuing that one more heavily? And maybe you are, I'm not aware of it from what I've read.
Well, we may. We're going to have some renderings, and staff is looking at this. I'm just speaking from our level here in the commission, and that's our directive to you. You know, you volunteered to do this, and I think I'm speaking for everyone that we like to have a narrowing of the site selections. And I particularly don't care where they are. I mean, they're coming from you, and that's what I want to evaluate is what you think is appropriate for a siting. And then we'll let that go to the people that are the experts on evaluating the logistics and the feasibility of it. But that's my perspective, and I don't mean to speak for the board, but that's how I
think. I think in speaking for the board, the question you posed, to be a little more direct, we have instructed staff to not bring us a choice, but to bring us options. And I think that's a really important distinction that there may be one site that ultimately may get chosen. It may already be on the list. It may not be on the list. But at this moment in time, the instructions from us as a commission is, for a variety of reasons, not least of those being the ultimate cost of it, we feel that the staff bringing us options rather than a recommended solution would be a better approach to us in our decision-making process. And everything that Commissioner Bergeron said before, I think, still holds. We really appreciate the input you're providing us, because you're leading us towards that path of options.
And we understand that completely. My hope is that we are able to continue at this point in Area 14 with pre-engineering studies, renderings, et cetera, cost analysis, and compare that hopefully to something south of the theoretical load line that we've already discussed here today, in view of the fact that the Franson property in 910 has been pulled off the table completely. So we're continuing to look for additional options to go along with the one that's been identified in the Chelan Heights Orchard area.
Yeah. Commissioner Congdon.
Well, I just want to add, these are two really civic-minded individuals, because their property has been pulled off the table. Maybe that's understood, maybe it's not. So they continue to pursue this and drive around and work and spend hours, drive down for our meeting, when they are not going to be impacted. I mean, their neighborhood is not going to be. So thank you. Thank you for that. And I just have a quick question for Caroline. You mentioned three developments, Lookout, Reserve, and what was the third one?
Crystal View.
Oh, Crystal View, yeah. You know that the reserve development it borders Site 14. You aware of that?
Yes, we're aware of that. And the location of the reserve, actually, when Chad and John and I went up to look at that, I'm not so sure that it was on the radar screen at that point, but it pulls the theoretical load line a little farther up lake.
It does.
Which helps to maybe justify the cost analysis results of the Chelan Heights Orchard Area 14 siting. And that also makes sense then that we could go a little farther southeast from the load line for the fourth North Shore substation parcel.
Yeah. I am impressed. The education, Chad, that you and John have done, these guys understand load center and the load lines, and that's very impressive.
Good work
on both accounts.
Staff is great.
Michael knows that lingo more. One other point on this Site 14, when walking around with Michael and driving around with my husband and everything, we will, from our house, even if it's at Site 14, we will have a view of that substation. Now, while I'm not crazy about a view of a substation, and I know somebody doesn't like the view up here of the Walmart, I remember that from the last meeting. I just want you to know I was paying attention. Even though I'll have a view of it, I'm not impacting the land, I'm not impacting the animals, I'm not impacting my neighbor's water or mine. It seems more remote, so I'm okay. Hmm. So I'm letting you know, I understand having a view of that thing, and I'll put up some emerald thulas or something, but I understand still being stuck with the view, and I'm willing to be stuck with that view, but in the right location, or as Chad says, perfect location.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Smith, just wanted to go back to the Leavenworth meeting. Mm-hmm. I believe that you can do this later, but just a reminder that you'll need to set a special meeting for that purpose.
If there's going to be three or more of us in attendance.
Yes.
Yes. And that is what date?
November 2nd at 5:30 at the Fire Hall in Leavenworth.
Be there. Oh, you'll be there.
Correction, it's at 6 o'clock.
Oh, sorry.
At the will you be at the Leavenworth meeting?
I will. I'll be back that morning. So is the fire hall right? It's very close to the PUD office in Leavenworth, isn't it?
Yeah.
You drive right by it. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, so then I think we will need to set a meeting, yes. Okay. Thank you. We can pick up that a little later. So, okay. Anything else on substation? Okay, moving to item 15, the Alcoa update and status of contract agreement.
Okay, I want to invite Kelly Boyd, CFO, and Michael Padgett from Alcoa up. There's been a really intense effort over the last few months, especially this last week, to work through the issues associated with the separation of Alcoa into a couple of different companies. And they're here to report on the progress of those discussions.
I just want to say, I believe Eric is on the telephone line as well. Eric, are you there?
So good afternoon, commissioners. For the record, I'm Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer. And joining me is Michael Padgett. He's the Vice President of Energy, currently Alcoa Inc., in the future, Alcoa Corp. And I'd also like to acknowledge that Eric Walquist will be joining us on the phone. We've had a real intense team effort, as Steve described. And I'd also like to acknowledge joining us for expertise in the audience is Carol Wardell, who has also contributed to our efforts here. So as quick background, I think that you will all remember that back in September of 2015, Alcoa announced its intention to split into two standalone companies. So one company would include the alumina and smelter upstream operations, and the second would include the downstream or engineered products division. That legal separation date has now been announced as November 1st. So as part of that action, our contracts and credit assurance with Alcoa Inc. will require our consent to assign to the new company. And we will be going with the new company, Alcoa Corporation, which is the upstream operations. So we have been working together with Alcoa to reach agreement on the consent and the contract assignment. And I'd also like to thank Michael for his extra efforts we've put in here the last few days. The November 1st date gave us a very challenging timeline, and we've worked to be up to the challenge. So our purpose today is to provide an overview of the potential assignment terms and other conditions that are necessary for the district to consent to the requested assignment. Excuse me. So we'll provide that overview and then also anchor into our principle that we used as we negotiated our terms of our contracts. And that principle was to have neutral to positive impact to the district and our customer owners from this action. We'll also review the items that need to be resolved in order for consent to become effective. Talk about the form of the consent agreement. I think we have a creative solution here to achieve consent and all of the associated actions that go along with that. We will review the key contract terms that remain so we can answer that question of what's different and what's still the same, and then we'll review our next steps. So to start with giving the overview of the separation, I'm going to ask Michael to provide that for you.
Good afternoon. I'm Michael Padgett, Vice President of Energy with Alcoa, based in our Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania office. And what we're here today is to talk about the culmination of over 1 year of activity as we've been working to separate the companies. As Kelly mentioned, the Alcoa Inc. that we have today will be separating into two standalone companies. They will be known as Alcoa Corporation, and that will handle all of the upstream facilities, and particularly the Wenatchee Works facility. And then also Arconic Inc., which will handle all of the what we call downstream activities. So that's the further fabrication and processing of the primary aluminum such as Wenatchee makes. The transaction steps, the first one I'll start with here is at the end of June, we filed Form 10 with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and that basically created Alcoa Upstream Corporation. And I know there's a lot of names going around, but Alcoa Upstream Corporation is the new entity that was created as the end of June. all of the upstream assets, the contracts and everything were then moved from Alcoa Inc. to the Alcoa Upstream Corporation, whereas downstream facilities, assets and contracts will remain with Alcoa Inc. for the time being. On legal day one, you're going to have two name changes. So Alcoa Upstream Corporation will just become Alcoa Corporation, and the current Alcoa Inc. legal entity will become Arconic Inc. And on November 1st, both companies will begin trading on the New York Stock Exchange as independent standalone entities. You can see we have the ticker symbols for both down at the bottom. So graphically, just to go into a little more detail so that you understand the process, I wanted to show the Wenatchee Works location. And on the left side, you're going to see the structure as it is pre-separation. So Alcoa Inc. as a legal entity basically owns all of the Wenatchee Works assets. Talk about the transaction steps, a couple of those below. Alcoa Inc. formed a wholly owned subsidiary called Alcoa Upstream Corporation. And then we formed a legal entity called Alcoa Wenatchee LLC, Limited Liability Corp. And that is a subsidiary of Alcoa Upstream. The Wenatchee Works assets have been transferred into the Alcoa Wenatchee LLC. And then on November 1st, you'll see the name changes. And the result of that will be the graphic that you see on the other side, post-separation. Arconic Inc. will continue to have a lot of subsidiaries and entities that I didn't show on here because the intent was just to show the transfer of Wenatchee Works.
And we could pause there. Are there any questions for Michael just about how the separation works and what it will look like? Okay. So as I mentioned, in order to have a way to negotiate and reach agreement on the actions that needed to happen for the separation, early on in the process, we agreed on a principle to use as our overarching guidance when we were negotiating items and deciding upon items. And that principle was that, and that was shared by Alcoa, was to ensure that the district and our customer owners interests in the power sales agreement were preserved and protected in a manner that was neutral or positive from the effects of Alcoa's proposed separation. So starting from this shared principle was one of the necessary things that really enabled us to reach this satisfactory resolution to the assignment and the related credit assurances in the challenging time frame that we had ahead of us. So describe the items that we needed, that we need to resolve in order for consent to be effective. I wanted to step back 1 minute and just kind of re-describe. So with the separation into two companies, our contract is currently with the company that will be renamed Arconic because it's with Alcoa Inc. And our contract needs to go to the new entity where the smelting assets and Wenatchee Works will be. So what we need to do there is Alcoa needs to assign the assets to Alcoa Corporation. But as part of our current power sales agreement, any assignment of that contract requires our consent before the contract can be assigned. And so that's what these items that we're talking about here are, is what are the elements that we need in order to consent to the assignment of the assets to Alcoa Corp. So what we have is we have a consent agreement, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. And in that agreement, it lines out the other agreement changes that are necessary in order for the assignment to become effective. So we have a current power sales agreement with Alcoa. That needs to have an amendment to it to recognize the assignment. We also have a collateral deposit agreement with the letter of credit that sets out the terms for performance assurance like letters of credit, and we would also need to have an amendment to that to recognize the separation. We have a transmission agreement that is a kind of a subset of the power sales agreement to get the power where it needs to go, and also the interconnection agreement that is vital to the between the power sales and the transmission agreement. So while we usually think of the one power sales agreement, we actually have a number of agreements here that all relate to our Alcoa activities, and all of these require amendments to recognize the assignment. So with that principle of having the results be neutral or positive to our customer owners, we applied that when working with credit assurance. In the new company, with going to Alcoa Corp, Alcoa Corp is a double is anticipated to be a double B minus rated entity as the separation becomes effective, and Alcoa Inc. was a higher rated entity at triple B minus by the Standard & Poor's rating agency. So one of the things we had to think about to remain neutral, with knowing that we had a different credit rating of our new counterparty, was we looked at the performance assurance terms that we had in both the power sales agreement and the related collateral deposit agreement, and made some adjustments to that to keep that protection at the same level. We also needed to ensure that the current letter of credit that we are holding covered both the existing company and the new company all the way through this transition, so there weren't any gaps of credit protection during the time where this legal separation is happening. One of the most challenging things, I think, about doing this, all of this contract work, was we're actually trying to agree now to things for a company that doesn't exist yet in Alcoa Corp, but it will exist after this legal separation date. So we have a interim company, the Alcoa Upstream, that we work through, but we're working ultimately to Alcoa Corp, which will become a company after the legal separation on November 1st. So all the names that we do talk about and all the different companies, it was very challenging to ensure that we had that proper coverage all the way through all of these activities, and that we didn't have any gaps in any sort of contract or credit protections.
So can let me ask, if I may, so what I'm understanding is the letter of credit would cover the gap created by the changing of the rating from triple B minus to double B minus.
That's one element of the collateral requirement. But so the existing letter of credit that we hold, some of the things that need to happen with that is it needs to have ensure that the name coverage, it's related to a certain entity, only Alcoa Inc.
Okay.
So we need to broaden that to make sure we cover the companies now and through separation. We also added a longer expiration date to ensure that it would be in place all the way through the end of July next year, after some of the key contractual dates occur. And we did that, again, as a reflection of more assurance with a lower credit quality entity that the letter of credit will be able to remain in place.
So those are the primary elements.
So those are the two elements to the existing letter of credit.
Okay.
But as we expand that thinking to future performance assurance, which I use that term because that's the term in the contract, but it's contract or credit assurance, just to ensure that there's proper credit protection there. So that's, I'll try to use that term. It's a better term. So what we did was we considered what's the additional exposure that we may have from having a different credit quality entity. And we wanted to ensure that we had adequate credit protection through the duration of the contract. Currently, in that letter of credit, we hold an amount that's the sum of the large settlement or the large deferred charge that would be due in the future should the curtailment last the 18-month term. So we hold that amount plus 3 months of monthly payments related to the contract. So the immediate exposure is already covered in the amount held. But as we contemplate the future and that the deferred amount is earned each year and it goes lower and lower each year, and there are hypothetical situations where that could be paid in full and we keep operating, we recognize that that balance could go pretty low as those amounts were earned over time. So what we did was we agreed to a modification of that calculation that sets a floor at $40 million plus the 3 months of operating costs, so that as the amount that's currently calculated goes down over time naturally, it would only go down to that certain level, and then it would hold there. We recalculate the 3 months of operating expenses annually, and so those kind of go up and down depending on either the last 12 months or the next 12 months. So that's those are trying to be responsive to what's going on in the current year. They change. And so that this floor just sets that amount that it will not go below to help us ensure that we have that adequate coverage over the long term of the contract. Okay. And so does that make sense in how
it does.
You describe that?
And so I just want to do that for a point of clarification, because this is my proverbial Albertson's grocery store aisle conversation. The letter of credit is a credit protection for the elements that you've described.
Correct.
Okay.
And it's for the long term of the contract.
For the long term of the contract.
Duration.
Mm-hmm.
Duration of the contract.
And I do want to throw that thinking in. So it's a reflection of the credit rating being at a certain level of the entity, and it provides that additional protection. Should the credit rating of the entity go back up to above a triple B minus per our existing contract, then that credit assurance is returned. But if the credit rating then goes back below that amount, then the credit assurance comes back. So there's a lot of moving parts that are trying to reflect the current circumstances.
Okay. Thank you.
Question here.
Got a question.
No, he has a comment. Michael has a comment.
Well, I was just going to say we talk about the expiration being extended to July 2017, but I want you to understand that the letters of credit still have an automatic renewal principle. So it is a long-term.
Okay.
Solution.
So if the 17th comes and goes, the 17th, then, but that's still covered in the.
Right.
It actually has then a 6-month automatic expiration, no other action being taken,
okay.
or renewal, no other action being taken. So it's a.
It just
rolling.
Rolls forward.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you, Michael. That was
Evergreen.
A great,
great
addition.
By curiosity, I mean, as we make these revisions in the contract, what's your view as far as the rating agencies would look upon this this contract revisions? How would that affect Cheyenne PUD?
So, again, with that same principle in mind, having such a large contract with a double B-minus company is one of the items that the rating agencies usually note in our evaluations of our overall credit. And by increasing some of the minimums in credit assurance and extending some of these terms, we feel that this will be a neutral view of keeping us in the same position and may be positive because of having the higher minimum when viewed by the rating agencies as they evaluate our credit.
You feel that the rating agencies will view it in that light then?
Yes. We think these are...
They like certainty, you know.
Yes, they do. And these are positive... positive elements of the separation agreement to help us maintain that.
Okay.
Gary.
What can you help me to understand what was the original, under the original contract, what was the formula for a declining rating from Alcoa? Now, this would be minus the split. So if Alcoa rating had simply fallen on its own, what was the remedy? In the old contract,
so it was the initial part that I described. So if the Alcoa Inc. were to fall below triple B minus rating by one of the three rating agencies, then the credit assurance or letter of credit clause came into effect and they needed to post a letter of credit. The amount of that letter of credit was the sum of the shutdown settlement amount, which is the large deferred charge of the year that you're in, plus 3 months of the operating costs for that month. And so each year that would be recalculated. And because the shutdown settlement amount goes down each year as that is earned by operating the plant, then that piece of the calculation would go down each year, just consistent. That was the existing. But it would go down all the way to zero through the end of the contract. So that those were the terms with the existing Alcoa Inc. So what the change is here is instead of keep going down and potentially going down to zero, it would only go down to the minimum level of $40 million. Once it hits there, even if the shutdown settlement amount continues to be earned over time and go lower, that element of the credit calculation would not change. It would stay at the
point. That helps me to understand the differences between the previous contract mm-hmm. and the current suggestion. Thank you.
So, I understand the difficulty of this, trying to negotiate for every possible item that could arise with a new entity, because we're not there yet. So is there anything built into this whereby we revisit it after the go live date, November 1 or what is it, November 1, right? Where we can revisit the terms because we're just anticipating what it probably is going to look like. Oh, that's long. Do we have any way to revisit these terms, because we're dealing with a corporation that isn't in existence yet, so we're trying to anticipate what it may look like? Does that make sense?
It does, and thank you for that question, because that's actually another important element of the collateral requirement calculation, is we try to anticipate a wide range of potential what-if scenarios and what's the chance of that happening. But as we go through time, we're, lots of times those assumptions change to something that one would have never expected, both up and down. So what we have in the draft amendment that we're working on for the collateral deposit agreement and the power sales agreement is a clause that says should circumstances change, both parties commit to renegotiate in good faith what would be the proper calculation based on the new circumstances at hand, and that can be both up and down in what that collateral requirement could be.
Perfect. So protection for both.
For both of us.
Okay, good. Thanks.
So the other really important element, too, as part of this transaction, is to ensure that the contract power retains its current requirement that power can only be used at the Wenatchee Works plant. So there is a provision in the existing contract that only allows that to be used here. That's part of that recognition of the value that Alcoa brings to the community by operating the plant. And there is a similar provision to ensure that the new entities that Michael described in that org chart, that even though the contract will be with the Alcoa Corp, which is the top of the org chart organization, and the assets are a number of layers into the organization at the Wenatchee Works local subsidiary, our contract being with this entity here and our current restrictions only being that only the entity that the contract is with can use the power, we needed to clarify that entity could use that power all the way through to the Wenatchee Works LLC and be able to use that, but still with that same restriction that it can only be used at the Wenatchee Works plant to do the smelter operations. It wouldn't be able to be transferred to another subsidiary within the organization, as an example. So that's a consistent provision to ensure that that holds even through the separation into the new company. Since the structure is different, the way we have to ensure that is a little bit different through the companies, but the end result is the same, that that power can only be used at Wenatchee Works. So the form of the consent agreement is the next item to talk about. This is where I'm going to describe it, but I have a feeling Eric might weigh in on a couple points just to ensure that I describe this exactly how it's intended to work. So, like I mentioned, there are a lot of contracts that related to our relationship with Alcoa that needed to be amended to reflect this separation. And while we knew that the targeted separation date was in the second half of 2016, and we were working towards that goal, the November 1st date, when it was announced of legal separation, shortened our amount of time that we had to work on that. So we knew that to come to the board with a description of how we thought the consent could work, the assignment could work, and what needed to happen with all the underlying agreements being amended was a really challenging task at hand, especially for all of those to be completed. So the idea of how this is set up is it's actually a conditional consent that we agree to first, but that conditional consent says, here are all the contracts that need to be in place, and here's all the additional information and certifications that would need to be required, and that we agree that in the big picture of things, these are all the things and these are the key things we need to keep, but all of the wording is not complete. Some of the, you know, the terminology and things still needs to be finalized. And so we recognize that we would agree now. It would be conditional on all these things being completed to everyone's satisfaction and signature, and that the consent would not actually become effective until all these things were done, but that we would agree to exactly what needs to be done now and then have a little bit more time to carry it out. And then if in that time frame that we agreed to, all the things didn't get put in place, then the consent would become void and it wouldn't be valid anymore. So our interests are all aligned of making sure that all of the documents and certifications that need to be happen for the consent to be effective, that they all happen in the time frame that we agree to. I wanted to pause there too. Eric, did you want to add anything to that description?
So good afternoon, commissioners. Eric Walpus, general counsel. No, Kelly, I actually think you described it very well.
And I do want to pause there in case there's any questions on that, because this is, again, this is a process that we tried to set up in this challenging time frame. So I wanted to make sure that made sense to everyone.
There's sort of an obvious question that leaps out at me looking at the last bullet point on that page. What happens if the consent becomes void?
So if the consent becomes void, that means that the assignment of the assets to the new company isn't effective, and it would remain with the existing company, Arconic.
Okay.
So,
Arconic.
And then there are lots of existing contract provisions that you would go through of now what needs to be done. So there are the same contract protections that exist now that give us that need to consent to the assignment. If there isn't that, then we would go through those contract provisions. So there is a contractual path that would happen through the current contracts. So there's adequate protection for customers there, but the most effective thing is for us to work together for agreeable resolution to these things so that everything will be effective. We want to reach the proper agreement so that the assignment is effective, the consent is effective, and we give every opportunity for Wenatchee Works to restart.
Right.
So with all that reverting back to Arconic, if these steps fail to occur, is that a brief description of Arconic still having umbrella authority?
So, commissioners, maybe I could try to take a shot at that question. So the most important thing, is my connection okay?
A little bit of scratchy when you speak loud. Maybe.
So I'll be quieter. So the most important thing, as Kelly has suggested, is that the district, through this process, does not give up any rights that it currently holds for its benefit or for the benefit of its customer owners. So in the event that this was not a successful assignment and there was not an effective consent, then as Kelly suggests, we revert back to all of those contract principles and protections that we currently hold for the benefit of the district and its customer owners. Part of those analyses will include what happens in the event that Alcoa Inc. separates into Arconic and Alcoa Corporation, who remains responsible for the contract in the event that there is not a valid transfer of those contract rights and obligations. There are a number of potential outcomes for that, but my answer, Commissioner, would be yes, we would be, in that event, looking to probably both of the resulting companies to protect the district's interest and its customer owner interest.
Okay, so both companies.
That's my perspective, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Of course, I share Kelly's enthusiasm for the fact that the beauty in my mind of this process is it protects the district's interests, yet also provides a very logical pathway to get all of the conditions that we need to have satisfied before that consent becomes effective. And you were talking earlier about some of the challenges with trying to get things accomplished with companies that aren't yet legally effective and won't be until November 1st. So this provides that nice window to get all of those conditions satisfied and for the consent to become effective without trying to rush to get them all done on a particular day or time certain. And we have set an outside window as to when those things must occur. Otherwise, we are literally back to the drawing board.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks, Kelly.
So I would like to reconfirm some of our key contract terms that we currently have, that those will remain after the consent and assignment. So we, you know, our contract will continue to incent restart and have the same principles that recognizes Alcoa's value that it brings to the community through operating the Wenatchee Works. The deferred contract charges are the same, and they have the same provisions should Wenatchee Works remain curtailed or should they restart. So there were no change in those deferred contract charges. The power, again, can only be used at the Wenatchee Works. And while they're curtailed, the power, that's their contractual power, is sold on Alcoa's behalf. Those proceeds are applied against the monthly cost to the contract. And then if there's any shortfall, customers are protected because Alcoa makes up that shortfall. And while they're curtailed, should there be any leftover after paying the monthly cost, then the district retains that. So far this year, it's been mostly a shortfall. So we haven't had a lot of, just maybe 1 month maybe of a little bit of surplus, although as we forecast forward, we think there'll be up and down months. So there hasn't been any significant buildup of any extra that we retained, but there has been monthly shortfalls that Alcoa has paid, the deficit. Alcoa also continue to provide the letter of credit for performance assurance that we currently hold. We have that protection for both companies that will ultimately exist. And then, you know, our bottom line, just like I emphasized before is we support restart of the plant and are ready to serve the plant consistent with all of our contract terms. So what are the next steps from here?
Yeah, go ahead.
May I comment? Is this on?
Yep.
Yeah, it's on. So contract aside, I have a question for Michael as long as we have him here. What is Alcoa's obligation for cleanup? That's a question that's on many people's minds, and I know it's aside from our contract, but, you know, we're trying to, you know, you talk about protecting the district and keeping it neutral. We want to do the same for the community, protect the community. So can you speak to that?
Sure. What we, each location, we basically have a list of the obligations or the potential exposures that cover a wide range, environmental issues, possibilities for renovating, remediation. And so I don't have the specific list of what those are for the Wenatchee Works site, but we do have that, you know, factored in with our environmental health and safety department. And if we have a site like Wenatchee that is curtailed, I mean, we don't have accruals set aside for it because, you know, it's not a permanent closure of the plant where we're intending to go in and remediate any of the things that might need to be to happen. So with the expectation that, you know, there's a possibility of coming back and running, we know what they are, but we don't have them specifically accrued, but we do have an overall funding, basically like a group where we would make sure we have funding that's adequate to cover our environmental responsibilities.
So just to clarify, I'm not sure I understood you. So the intent is not to permanently close the plant. Upon permanently closing the plant, then Alcoa would be obligated to come in and clean up the site. But even if you go to a permanent shutdown, is that what we call it? Permanent shutdown as of next June, right? That's not permanent closure, which then wouldn't kick us into remediation?
That's correct. That's more of a, and again, I'm getting in an area where I'm not as familiar, but that's generally a state-by-state set of responsibilities that based on what action you take at the facility is when the state comes in and says you have compliance deadlines and you have remediation deadlines. So, again, I don't know what they are specifically for Wenatchee and within Washington. But.
Okay, thank you.
I would like to add one thing, too, just for that understanding. So next June, it's a due date for a payment that was deferred at the beginning of the contract and is encouraging operations. So there are due dates when it would become due if there isn't operations, but it's not a any sort of requirement that the plant is now shut down or that's a decision date. There is still opportunity to restart after that date for the contract to continue for any of those number of things. So it's a due date for that deferred charge, but it is not a decision or a factor in the decision around if there was to be a long-term shutdown.
Okay. I didn't understand that before. That helps. Yeah. What is the price of aluminum right now?
We've actually had a nice... Well, compared to where we were, a little bit of an increase. It's still not as high as we would like, but it's in the 1700s.
Thank you for coming.
Okay. Yeah. So, Kelly, then there will be two letters of credit. Will they be issued from the same bank or separate banks?
So it is flexible as far as how to provide that assurance, mm-hmm. but currently in the work that Alcoa is doing to make these changes about expanding the entities that are covered by the letter of credit. It is our current understanding that the execution currently will be to have two different banks to split the current letter of credit.
Yeah.
And we have some criteria in the power sales agreement of the quality of the banks that can provide the letters of credit. And so as long as those banks meet that criteria, which they do, we're working together to ensure that we're all in line on that, then it's perfectly acceptable for us to have multiple letters of credit. in fact, there's some positive around it because you don't have all your eggs in one basket.
Well, that's my you know, where I was going with the question was, it seems like that mitigates the risk actually for both.
It can, as long as those quality banks that one or
because we could have a bank that's too big to fail, right?
Yeah,
and I would not want both letters coming from the same big bank that was too big to fail.
Yeah, they, you know, it can if it's a quality bank, but in the current path, it looks like there will be two.
Mm-hmm. Good. And neither's Lehman's. Just
correct.
Yeah.
Okay, well, to talk about next steps a little bit. So we do have a consent agreement and an assignment agreement where we have collectively agreed to the terms of those contracts. Those are kind of those two first contracts that needed to be in place for us to be able to come to the board and talk about how we can accomplish all of this. The contract, or the consent contract being that one that lists out all the steps, the assignment being one of those first steps for Alcoa to be able to meet what they need to do before the legal separation. So those two contracts, we do have agreement in language on those, and the next step would be for Alcoa to sign those. The next step after that would be about how we ultimately would sign those, which is always along the path of first, the board has to approve the actions and then approve how we want to carry out the authority to do that. So in requesting board action, we have a couple steps here. Knowing that we are just introducing the overall information here and providing what the what we are doing to protect our customer owners, we know that we need to come back to the board requesting approval. And we would like to do that in advance of November 1st when the legal separation occurs to assure that there are no gaps in contract coverage. So again, this is that challenging piece about contract being with one entity but being with another entity on November 1st. So we understand the challenging timeline here and would like to have a time set for seeking board approval prior to November 1st. At that time, we would present a resolution to the board to request that how we would carry this out is by delegating authority to the general manager to sign all those relevant agreements that I listed out, consistent with the terms that we've talked about in this briefing. So I mentioned that part of this process, how it works, is we don't have all the final language on all of those agreements, but we do have agreements and substantial principle of all these things that we described that we're going to retain in those agreements. So the resolution is a request to delegate to the general manager to sign all of those when they are ready, consistent with what you've heard today. After all those steps were done, all of the agreements were signed, then all of the agreements, including the consent, would become effective, but not until then. So I've listed those steps out, but maybe we could go back to any that you might have questions on or any that we like, how you would like to proceed from here.
I'd like to just add to the presentation to say that I am personally comfortable that this meets the test of positive to neutral. Basically, what we're dealing with is a smaller company than the one before. You take Alcoa and you split it into Arconic and Alcoa, and clearly it's a smaller company. And it's a less creditworthy company because of the what we've heard from the rating agencies, who are the most expert people that we can rely upon here. Having said that, we do get credit assurance through what is a really critical period. If the plant stays shut down, there is this large payment that is due in June, and we get credit assurance that goes beyond what the existing contract would require, which was a 90-day rolling letter of credit. And second, it addresses the period post-July by, again, because we're dealing with a less creditworthy company, the question is, will they be able to make payments if they're due? So the fact that you have this three-month rolling plus the $40 million that doesn't exist in the existing contract gives me confidence in terms of weighing those trade-offs that we meet the test of positive to neutral.
Commissioners?
Mr. President,
yes.
So are you clear on what we need to do today?
Yep, I am.
You are, good.
I am.
I'm not.
Okay. I think management would like for us to, recognizing we do not have another meeting scheduled as a commission until November 7th, they would like for us to set another board meeting to provide time for the proposed resolutions to be posted and for the public to see that and for us to deliberate and consider and hopefully pass in a timely fashion prior to November 1, which maximizes our security, minimizes our exposure.
Yes, Commissioner, if I may, this is Eric Wahlquist. I think it's imperative that we have the resolution considered, and if it's the board's decision adopted prior to November 1.
And I'd like to add that we recognize that this is happening in a relatively short time frame, but we want to create opportunity for public review and comment. So it would be our intention to post the two agreements that we believe are done between Alcoa and Chelan, at least at the staff management level, which are the assignment agreement and the conditional consent agreements. We will also plan to post the four contracts in their current state, although there's still some wording being worked out there. We believe that conceptually we're in agreement. We don't believe that we have any significant changes that will occur before we'd be ready to proceed, but we're prepared to post them anyway so that the public can see everything out there that we'd be talking about changing. And then we'd also post the proposed resolution. So the resolution gives the authority to the general manager to proceed with signing the appropriate documents and the conditions upon which it would be appropriate for that signature to take place. The key to that is the completion of the six agreements that I've just described. And I would note that it's also that we have in place the letter of credit with the expiration in July. It covers the $86 million that takes care of all amounts that could, the 3 months plus the payment that could be due at that point, as well as the commitment to have the $40 million part of the letter of credit for the post-July period, along with, again, the rolling 3 months. So it would be clear that the terms that have been described to you here today would have to be met in order for the general manager to proceed with signing the agreements.
Now, from a logistics standpoint, I think most of us are aware that a couple commissioners will be gone the end of this week and not return prior to the 1st of November.
And I'll be gone the 24th. I'll be gone the 24th through the 2nd.
And so the only time that all five of us for sure might be here is this week.
Looks like it.
To get that discussion started, is that what you're looking for?
Yep.
I propose a special board meeting then for consideration sometime on Thursday, October 20th.
Now, recognizing that... Okay. Steve will be out of town and would need to call in on that particular day. That would be fine with me if it was not an issue with any of you.
I just have a 3:15 appointment that day is all I have.
On Thursday?
On Thursday, but it's here in Wenatchee.
Yeah. So I just said, you know, early Thursday, but certainly it could be more accommodating for your time frame.
1 o'clock would be nice.
Yeah, I have a morning appointment on Thursday, so Thursday's wide open.
And I'll make it easy. I'm free all day, and if Steve could call in, that would be great. I'm in support of that.
And you say you have an afternoon appointment?
3:20.
But you said 1 o'clock would be?
1 o'clock would work for me very well.
I'm free all day.
Yeah. Eric?
Oh, thanks, commissioners. So I just wanted to let you know that I'll be traveling that day in the afternoon back to Wenatchee. Call in the morning. But certainly also think that we'd be at a point then that if you'd like me on the line, I'd be unavailable from 1 until 5. But I have great confidence in Kelly. She's given you the information today. You should see nothing during that meeting that is in conflict with anything that you've heard today.
Okay. I'm hearing, recognizing the short time frame, and the Thursday afternoon provides the maximum amount of time for the public to have access to this documentation. And I think that's always important with all of us, that we give whatever time we can for the public to, you know, provide us feedback. It sounds like 1 o'clock Thursday is where we're coming down.
That would accommodate needs that I would have, yeah.
And would you be available to call in at that time? Okay.
Yeah, and with all due respect, Counselor, we do have other attorneys that can sit in.
Thank you. I'll be there, too.
I mean, we'd miss
you. Receiving those texts.
We would miss you dearly.
How are you?
Okay. If that's the case, is there a motion to set a special meeting for 1 p.m. Thursday afternoon, October 20?
Correct.
Here in the boardroom? Don't think we need to have a special reason. It's just a special board meeting.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we set a special meeting here in the boardroom, October 20, 1 p.m., special board meeting for the Board of Commissioners.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to set a special meeting for 1 p.m. October 20 here in the boardroom. That's it.
I would just invite Michael, I don't need to stay in Wenatchee, but if you could be on the phone, I think it would be helpful in case we got questions from the public about the agreement.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, just I would like to clarify for the sake of the public that this is a very, very short notice, very unusual move on the part of the commission to move it forward at this degree. But as a commissioner, I feel that staff and management has done an excellent job of keeping us apprised of where the situation is leading up to this. And I would encourage the public over the next couple of days to review the primary pieces of consideration that will be, you know, online later today, and give us feedback as we can. So it's a rushed time schedule, but I don't think it's a rushed discussion, and I think that's important to understand.
Well stated. Any other discussion to the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor of setting a special motion or special meeting for October 20th, 1 p.m. here in the boardroom, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried.
Thank you, commissioners.
Yes. Commissioner, can I just one question I wanted to ask of Michael, and because it's stated in both the contracts and the resolution. Your discussion of the organizational structure didn't include APGI, but they are identified on the contract. Could you just describe the role of Alcoa Power Generating Incorporated?
Sure. Alcoa Power Generating is a FERC registered entity, and you may have heard about the Colocum asset. It's basically a very short span of transmission that runs from the station down into the plant, and so because of that, APGI is a party to all of these agreements. but it will remain a subsidiary of Alcoa Corporation. It's moving over from the Alcoa Inc. today into Alcoa Corporation. We've already filed that with FERC for that to happen.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Right.
I would just like to say one other thing. I very much appreciate the commission's consideration in getting us in, and I'd also like to point out I think the Chelan staff has been just fantastic in working with us to get this put together. So,
thank you. It's been a good working agreement for 50 years. No sense parting company differentiated from that at this point.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay. Now we need to move back up to our regular agenda. Resolution number 10.
Number 10 is a resolution authorizing final acceptance of performance under bid number 15-40 with Trenchless Construction Services, LLC of Arlington, Washington, and authorizing payment of retainage. And Chamberlain is going to present today.
Good afternoon, Vern Chamberlain. Project Management Department Manager in Engineering Services. I see my, I got stiffed by my partner, Randy Nolan. He's supposed to be up here to talk a little bit about how this whole thing worked. But this resolution authorizes final acceptance of bid 15-40 with Trenchless Construction. The scope of the contract is to perform underground. Too close? Underground conduit installation using directional drilling. This method significantly reduces the need for trenching and minimizes road closures affecting homes and businesses during construction. Utilities are located with a vacuum truck to negate utility damage, and a pit is excavated at the beginning of the conduit run and also at the end. Then the drill head is then controlled from start to finish. This method of construction, conduit installation, works well with many distribution projects. So the lessons learned is we've put this contract together for the work that we've done in the last 6 or 7 years in Cashmere and Wenatchee, and it's worked well. We've got all the correct bid items. The lessons learned is that if we need to put this contract together again, we're ready to go, and it won't take very long to do that. As it turns out, I did get a note just a couple of last Friday that they want to put another one together, so I'm ready to go. In fact, we're already started.
Great.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Number 11 is a resolution declaring Alstom Power Incorporated of Littleton, Colorado, as the sole source supplier of turbine guide bearing sleeves for Lake Chelan units A1 and A2. George Velasquez will present.
Good afternoon. George Velasquez, Rocky Reach Lake Chelan EPM Manager. I'll be presenting a resolution declaring Alstom Power Inc. of Littleton, Colorado as the sole source supplier for the turbine guide bearing sleeves for Lake Chelan. And these are interchangeable for units 1 and 2. Under original contract 0601, Lake Chelan Hydro Modernization, Alstom had the scope of including completion of turbine model testing, designing, inspection, refurbishment, modifications, delivery, and installation of rehabilitation of units A1 and A2 at Lake Chelan Hydro Facility back in 2001. This resolution is requesting a sole source that includes the turbine guide bearing, the also known as the TBG sleeve, design, manufacture, delivery of that turbine guide bearing sleeve. Per the terms and conditions of the contract 0601 back in 2001 that we executed with Alstom, the design and specifications of that turbine guide bearing sleeve and other appurtenances were a proprietary design by Alstom. The turbine guide bearing sleeve is currently manufactured and solely supplied by Alstom. The district's engineering and project management team has determined that the sleeve, the spare sleeve that we're requesting sole sourcing, is necessary to ensure efficient operations for our units A1 and A2 at Lake Chelan Dam. We are in need of a spare sleeve. During rehabilitation in 2014, we had to remove one of the existing sleeves and replace it with our spare sleeve. So right now we're running with no spare. The engineering and project management team has conducted a diligent review of our existing contractors and potential sources to ensure that Alstom is clearly and legitimately the only sole source provider for this sleeve. We have also acquired certification that they are the that the pricing of $52,500 is the lowest price available for Chelan County PUD and like entities. So we originally started out with a proposal by Alstom for $140,000 for this work. We negotiated with them and also worked with them to improve the design on their sleeves because we also saw that indications were showing that they weren't lasting as long as they should have. So with this $52,500 price, we're working with them on refining that design so that we get the life out of them as well. Any questions?
Yeah, just a question, George. When these were instigated in 2001, was it around 2007 when we rebuilt the two turbines? And that was Alstom as well.
That's correct.
So it's my guess is that the bearing sleeves were of such quality then that they could remain and then just now be replaced with a...
Yeah, so so all of the components under contract 06-01 are still in operation. Okay. We did a rehabilitation in 2014 that showed some indications on the sleeve in the ceramic lining on the sleeve that required us to replace it. Okay. So all of their components currently on A1 and A2 are functioning properly. For whatever reason, the ceramic coating on this sleeve that goes between the turbine guide bearing that keeps that thing aligned and the shaft, for some reason, the ceramic coating was showing failure indications, and that's...
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I had just one totally off the subject question, but it surfaced when you Alstom being headquartered in Littleton, Colorado. I thought they were a French company.
They are originally. They have offices in Sorel Tracy, Canada, as well, and then the North American office is in Littleton, Colorado. So our current proposal came from Littleton, Colorado. And that's why you're seeing that address on this resolution.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
I believe we're moving on to Resolution 13, resolution rejecting the bid of Fusion Babbitting Company Incorporated and accepting the bid of American Babbitt Bearing Incorporated of Huntington, West Virginia, bid 16-SW27 for the Rocky Reach Unit C5 thrust bearing shoes rebabbit.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Christy Van Wagner. I work in the Procurement and Contract Services Department.
And I'm Penny Hulbert. I'm Senior Plant Mechanical Engineer at Rocky Reach.
This resolution is requesting approval to reject the apparent low bid provided by Fusion Babbitting and award to the apparent second low bid provided by American Babbitt Bearing. We opened bids on Friday, October 7th, and we received these two bids. And the bid provided by Fusion contained exceptions to our contract language. So we would like to reject them and award to American Babbitt Bearing, which was a compliant bid. Any questions?
Yeah. I am familiar with the farm term of Babbitt and Babbitting. So how is that term applied in this setting?
How is it applied?
So, well, yeah, what a Babbitt in this situation is, because we have Babbitt and Rebabbitt,
Yeah, we have the thrust bearing shoes. We have 16 of them, and they, of course, take both the up thrust and the down thrust for the generating units. These are shoes that have a metal base that, of course, is the structural part, and then a thin layer of babbitt, like you would see on probably any kind of bearing. What happens is this babbitt layer either becomes unbonded or has damage or, you know, whatnot, things like that during our inspections, during overhauls. And the ones that we brought out of Unit 7 actually were showing quite a bit of cracking and damage that required them to have that old babbitt removed and reapplied. Actually, Unit 5, I guess, on this one.
But. So the babbitt in this case is a protective layer.
Yes, it's an alloy, mostly tin. It used to be lead, mostly lead, but it has a combination of things, tin being one of the main main components of it. It's actually softer material as far as, you know, it could be easily damaged like with sharp things or things like that, but it provides a smoother surface that prevents, like, if you had steel on steel, you might get galling or things mm-hmm. like that. So this supplies a smooth surface that also helps provide for oil film to develop in between the mating surfaces, so you have a less friction.
Okay, thank you. That helps.
Commissioner Congdon.
Well, I just have to say welcome to the boardroom. You've been in the boardroom before, right?
Yes.
But you haven't.
It's been a long time.
What's your name? I didn't get your name.
Penny Holbert.
Penny. Yeah. Well, I just want to say I love seeing smart, accomplished, professional women come before us, and it's exciting for me to see that this company, that Schlan PUD, offers so much opportunity for women. So congratulations. I love it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
So, Commissioners, I made an error a moment ago. I was thinking that Item 12 had been moved, but it did not. So come back to Item 12, a resolution approving a pilot electric vehicle charge sub-metered energy service agreement with North Central Washington Economic Development District. Andrew Grissel will present.
Good afternoon. Andrew Grissel, Manager in Energy Development and Conservation. We talked a little bit about this morning at the update. This resolution will provide the district with the authority to enter into an agreement with the North Central Washington Economic Development District, and you notice that plug-in North Central Washington is also included within that, and they're a subcommittee underneath that. And so the agreement is to enter an agreement with them so that they can pay for the electricity that is used at our charging stations. The rate that is included in there is 2.7. Make sure I get that right. 2.7 cents. This rate equals our energy rate in our Schedule 2 for customers under 40 kW. It's also consistent with the rate that we would charge ourselves. The district, we won't charge a monthly fee on this on these, and there are several reasons why. One, there's value to us from being able to have a pilot study and to be able to gather the information, load information, time of use information, all these sorts of things that would better inform us in the future. They're located at installations that already have a service to them, so they're not new per se. There's the value that we've talked about earlier this morning is postponing payment technology sometime out in the future, where we don't have to purchase that now, but we're able to postpone that and gather and learn that information there. So all those values combined are reasons for that. And so the agreement can be terminated by either party with a 90-day written termination. And I'll open for any questions.
Just an observation, Andrew. Steve indicated that he thought this was going to be moved to the consent agenda, and I'm sure the reason my fellow commissioners didn't move it is they didn't think you'd been getting enough publicity in the news media lately. And so congratulations on your elevated profile in the community with GWADA and all of the other.
Thanks.
and the charging station dedication. So, great job.
All right. Thank you.
That's it. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
14 is our last resolution declaring Consolidated Electrical Distributors Incorporated DBA Columbia Electric Supply of Yakima, Washington as the sole source supplier of Allen Bradley Motor Control Centers for the Rock Island Units B5 through B8. John Sagerson is going to present for us.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm John Sagerson. I'm the engineering manager down at Rock Island. Again, this is a resolution declaring Consolidated Electric Distributors doing business as Columbia Electric Supply of Yakima as the sole source supplier for Allen Bradley Motor Control Centers for Rock Island Units B5 through B8. As you remember, Rock Island Units B9 and B10 were refurbished by Andritz Hydro under contract 0401 several years ago. Andritz, in their scope of supply, provided Allen Bradley Motor Control Centers for those two units. Since then, we have taken the supply of the motor control centers and most of the electrical work through field work order change order out of Andritz's scope of supply and are doing that internally with district resources, both engineering and with the installation with our own wiremen. What we've discovered, though, is that the Allen Bradley control centers are very good control centers. They're low cost, they're robust, they're reliable. We've also found that district crews, both technicians, wiremen, operators, have invested significant time and training in understanding the motor control centers, specialty tools to perform maintenance, software to program and diagnose any problems with them. And so we would like to capitalize on that investment that they've already made in training and education, which is why we justified a sole brand justification for Allen Bradley Motor Control Centers. This also allows us to minimize our future investments in spare parts and other inventory items because we have the same type of motor control centers for that whole family of units, which would be B5 through B10 at Rock Island. Unfortunately, Consolidated Electric Distributors, or Columbia Valley Electric, has a limited marketing agreement with Allen Bradley, where they are the only company that you can buy for entities in our geographic region can only buy Allen Bradley Motor Control Centers from them. So due to that limited marketing agreement, we are here today asking for you to authorize a sole source for with them for Allen Bradley Control Centers, Motor Control Centers, for Rock Island B units B5 through B8 at a cost not to exceed $300,000. Questions?
Any questions?
Great explanation.
It is.
Thank you. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Commissioners, we have resolutions 10 through 14 before us. What is your desire?
Mr. Chairman, I move the approval of resolutions 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14 as they have been presented.
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve resolutions 10 through 14. Is there any discussion of the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. So do we have any other manager items?
We do not.
I think we covered commission items this morning. We did follow up on delegation. Are there delegation items from today?
Yeah, quite a few, actually. So first of all, we've got a commitment to get back to you with respect to the potential for employment for disabled workers. So we'll set a time frame for that. I'm not sure just what the time frame will be, but we'll get back to you by the next meeting at least to set a time frame. We've got a commitment to get back regarding the cybersecurity concerns. Again, we've been preparing a briefing, so we'll make sure that we get that pulled together before the end of the year. The Waputa budget issue, there's a request for me to make some contact with Waputa fellow managers, George Kahn. So I'll work with Commissioner Bowles in particular on that. Request to look at participation in the festival that the name we couldn't remember, but it's put on by El Mundo and Gustavo Montoya. So we'll be looking into that. We made a commitment that we will post the six ALCOA agreements and the draft resolution. We plan to do that this afternoon so that they are available for the public, so that we would be in a position to take action at a Thursday 1 o'clock board meeting. And then coming out of the substation discussion, I think, although we didn't identify this one specifically, but I think it is a task for us to follow up on looking into the golf course properties. Okay. That's what I've got. Miss anything?
I don't think you ever do. You do a great job.
We also have need to set a special meeting for November 2nd at 6 p.m. or is it 5 p.m.?
6 p.m., he clarified.
6 p.m. at the Leavenworth Fire Hall. For the purpose of, well, it's a public meeting. It's going to be for the substation discussion. So,
6 o'clock, November 6th.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'll move that we set a special meeting for November 2nd, Leavenworth Fire Hall, 6 p.m., for the discussion, public discussion of siting a substation.
Correct.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to set November 2nd, 6 p.m., Leavenworth Fire Hall for public meeting purpose of discussing substation siting. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. Is there any additional public comment? Don't believe there is. We are in need of an executive session of... Before that, are there any other matters that need to come before the commission?
I just have a question. We have three young people in the back row. Are you guys doing school-related work? Yeah. So you're fulfilling a
public meeting.
Public meeting, and you stayed for the whole meeting, and you stayed for the entire the long meeting you chose to come to. Good. Thank you.
Sister Wenatchee High School Social Studies. CWP, yeah, and who's your instructor, if I may ask? Because I was in that department for 15 years. Oh, God bless you. And tell him I said so.
I just want to say thank you. I recognize one of the students as being my next-door neighbor, Jacob Barnwell. So,
nice.
AJ, yeah. Calling out to you.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah, you can ask Mr. Benner what he wore on the day of his... interview, and it'll crack you up. So go ahead and ask him, because you know he's fair game for most anything. Yeah.
I think I heard that story.
Okay. That'd be a good idea. While we're passing the mic, I just want to let you know that I think the problem that we're having here over there, if you see these new cords, I don't know that we got around and tested everything. They replaced these on Friday.
Oh.
I bet that's what it is. Thank you.
So I'm Maddie LaLanne, and if anyone knows Michelle LaLanne, who's the science coordinator at the ESD, that's my mom. Oh.
I'm Christina Heater.
And as previously stated, I'm Jacob Barnwell.
Welcome and thank you.
Thank you.
Nobody will stare you for the whole meeting, but you did.
Yes. All right. How long of an executive session do we need?
Let's go for 90 minutes.
We are in need of a 90-minute executive session following about a 7-minute break. We'll reconvene about 10 minutes to 3 for 90 minutes. We're coming out of executive session. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. It's currently 4:30. Is there any other business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we'll stand adjourned.